atop the skyline of downtown Chicago to 38 states and Canada. Your host for this evening, Justin Kaufman.
Tonight on the program, Governor Pritzker introduces two budgets, one with the graduated income tax revenue and one without. Republicans are crying foul. Is this reality or political smoke and mirrors? And promised education funding is being held hostage, and that has some educators in the state upset. We'll talk about what this budget means for Illinois schools. And 11 years ago, Chicago journalists came together for an emergency town hall. They didn't like the writing on the wall. This weekend, they reconvene. Are Chicago's media institutions worse off than they were 10 years ago? Hello, good evening, and welcome. I'm Justin Kaufman on the air till 11 o'clock tonight. The phone lines are open, 312-981-7200. You can call, you can text, like I said, with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Happy to be here, but those stories are just the tip of the iceberg for tonight's program. World Series champion manager Ozzie Guillen will be in studio. He and his sons are teaming up for a new podcast for La Vida Baseball, which celebrates Latinos in the sport. Ozzie, of course, calls Chicago home. We'll talk about his days managing the club, how baseball has changed, and, of course, the current cheating scandal. He'll be in here in the 9 o'clock hour with his son, Ozzie Jr. And the question is, should I or should I not tell him about catching his foul ball at the old Comiskey Park? Probably not. It was it's just razzing him because it was a bunt. He popped it up deep into the stands. I don't think he moved the runner along. So maybe it's sour. And Greg Flam will be happy to know from swap meet that I lost that ball somewhere. So I didn't even get it signed. Also, did you read Blair Kamen's piece today on the return of wood-based building in Chicago? Did you see this story? Timber is the new rage, and it's coming to some of the new mega developments being built, including the 78 along the south branch of the Chicago River. But too soon? I say too soon. It was the rash of wood-built buildings that burned during the Great Chicago Fire. Maybe it's cheaper, but again, maybe not in Chicago. Just a thought. We can talk about that. And spring break destinations ranked. What's your favorite place to get away during Chicago winters? It's another rousing rendition of my favorite segment. Tell me about your vacation. 312-981-7200. But first tonight, will a good verbal barb in a public place, this is the new story, result in a ticket, a fine? That's the idea from one Chicago alderman. Chicago downtown alderman Brendan Riley introduced an ordinance on Wednesday. He was on Bob Surratt this morning talking about a measure that would prohibit people from directing insults, taunts, or, quote, offensively coarse language towards anybody else in a public place. Riley said it's a shame you have to legislate this, but you have to legislate being a decent human being. But they do. His proposal would ban conduct that would cause a reasonable person to be seriously alarmed, annoyed, tormented, or terrorized. And the conduct, in fact, seriously alarms, annoys, torments, or terrorizes such person. Fines up to $250 could be levied against violators. Wow. This really has to do with aggressive panhandlers and harassment in that area. If you have been downtown Chicago, that is something that has been on the rise. Not that there should be any, I guess, stated upon engagement when it comes to panhandling, but there is an unwritten rule that you ask for money, you say yes or no, and that's the end of said relationship, transaction, if you will. But we're seeing more and more situations where people get followed down the street, they get harassed, they get yelled at for not having. This happened to me. Happened to me last week. I went out for that pub trivia crawl. The last bar was on Hubbard Street. I came out to get a ride share with my wife. A man asked me for money. I said I didn't have any. Then started to berate us on the corner. Now, with this new ordinance, I too would get a violation or a fine because I berated back, which my wife told me was inappropriate for me to do as I was. My line, which was not very, I will say this, not very aggressive nor intimidating, was, "Don't you start." That's what I said back. "Don't you start with me." yelling it on the street, Chicago at 1 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday night. What do you think of this? I think it's a problem. If it wasn't a problem, it wouldn't be brought up at city council. But at the same time, as the mayor said, can you really legislate words? Are we going to fine people for talking, shouting, being loud, annoying? Oh, geez. I could see a couple of people in my life I know I would love to give a $50 fine to for talking too loud and being annoying. Let's start with the people who listen to their phone on speaker or listen to the music in public places. That's a fine. But let's stick right now to verbal harassment. Should it be a fine? Is Alderman Riley onto something? 312-981-7200. We'll start the conversation there. We'll take a break. Get you guys lined up, and let's talk about it tonight in a mild-mannered, respectful way. 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman with you here on 720 WGN. Coming up, it's after 7:30. Cassie Walker-Burke's going to join us to talk about educators and how miffed they are at the governor for suggesting that he would withhold education funding that was promised to them. This is the fallout from proposing two different budgets. If you pass my graduated income tax proposal, if you vote for it, then I'll give you your funding. If you don't, you don't get it. 312-981-7200. We're talking about verbal harassment and whether or not that is something that could be a violation, not a moving, they're walking, maybe it's a moving violation, a verbal violation. Fines up to $250. Alderman Brendan Riley, the downtown alderman, the 42nd ward, has introduced a measure that would curb verbal harassment, which we're seeing on the uptick in downtown Chicago. Otto, what do you think of it? Do you think that's a good idea?
No, I'm against it. I just think this is another way for politicians and people to put their hands in our pocket and take more money. I mean, don't we have people getting shot to death every weekend and we're worried about, you know, verbal harassment? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're getting so soft as a society, we're going to fine people over language.
Yeah.
Is this guy a millennial? How old is this guy?
The alderman is probably in his 40s. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I wonder. Yeah. It has to be an issue, though, if he's going to put it in. I'm not saying he's doing stupid, you know, he's just playing with time, he's got nothing to do. It's obviously become an issue in River North and downtown Chicago because tourists come down there. That's the problem, right? Tourists come down and they go to the restaurants and they go to the bars down there, and there are a lot of, if they're homeless or not or whatever it is, but there are a lot of street people, is that the best way to say it, that are coming down there and harassing people as they walk out of these restaurants. And I think that's where he's going with it. I'm not sure if it's the right way to go, but Ron, what do you think? Ron, do you think this is a good idea?
No, I think it's just utter nonsense. The people that they would get the fine, do you think they would actually come to court to actually pay the fine?
Right. That's a great point.
It's similar to me to Chicago being a sanctuary city. They can't protect their own citizens, but it's a sanctuary city.
Yeah.
You got to understand, I guess there's an idiot factor and clowns and you know, fools that you're just going to have to put up with if you're going to live in a metropolitan city. So you're going to have to kind of grin and bear it and, you know, go about your business.
Right. Thanks, Ron. Yeah, he's right. I don't know how you, as Mary says, good evening, Mary, regarding this ordinance from Alderman Riley, I'm wondering how it would be enforced. Thinking of the situation you described with you and your wife, talking about what I just said, how could anyone lodge a complaint with a law enforcement officer at that moment and have it followed up? I'm not sure what the answer to this question is. Just imagining a scenario, and it seems very difficult to enforce. The only way you could enforce it is if a police officer was there, which I'm sure down on Hubbard Street, downtown Chicago, I like to call it Clubbard Street, you know, because I'm hip to the lingo. That's where all the clubs are at. That there's a lot of cops walking the beat. So maybe this is an opportunity to help police officers with that conflict by giving them something they can ticket. As someone else said, it wouldn't fall into disorderly conduct. I wonder if disorderly conduct is not a finable offense. That's an arrestable offense. You don't want to be arresting these. I don't know. I don't know the answer. Maybe it's just a deterrent. And at the same time, and Alderman Riley was on Bob Surratt, and he's been on with Roe. He's always on the programs. He had to be motivated to do it for some reason. And maybe it's just a deterrent. Maybe it's just a warning shot across the bow, if you will, saying enough is enough. Stop harassing people on the street. As an alderman, there's not much I can do. All I can do is try to deter it with a measure or an ordinance or something of that nature. 312-981-7200. It's a free speech violation, says 815. It'll never hold up in court. Again, it's not an arrest. It's a ticket. I'm not sure what the fine would be. They said up to $250. And that's what everyone is saying. 312 says homeless are afford to pay. I don't know. This is, it's an interesting, I find myself, because I'm complete, when I first saw this story, I was completely with everyone who's calling in. No way. But I understand that this is an issue. And as someone who just had it happen to him, if this is happening 40 times, 30 times, 20 times a night down on Hubbard Street by a handful of people, who do you think they call when they get home saying, I had a great time, I spent $300 downtown, but I'm going to call my alderman because at the end of that, it soured the whole mood, the way I was harassed all the way back to my car. It's not right. Cindy, what do you think?
Hey, hi. You know, a lot of these people that do this, you know, they've probably been dealing with rejection all day, not to mention maybe a lifetime.
Right.
And I'm not certainly sticking up for them, but, you know, there's a lot of mental health issues with people that are down on the streets at all times of the day and night, and especially with your encounter. You know, if you've had a couple of cocktails, you're a lot less tolerant. And, you know, my advice is just to, like your mother always said, just pay no attention. Keep walking.
Wow, you sound just like my wife.
Well, here's the deal. If a sailboat gets no wind, it goes nowhere. And they're just, you know, they're angry people maybe anyway, because their life is really so unpleasant.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I think reasonable heads have to prevail and just ignore them, you know?
I agree. Cindy, thank you for the call. It was a very funny, teachable moment where my wife brought the story back to my 12-year-old son. He wasn't with us. He was, you know, home with the babysitter. The next day we're talking about it. And I don't know how it came up. He's asking how the night was. And my wife said, it was a nice night, but it almost ended with, you know, your dad getting in a fight. And I was like, it wasn't a fight. It was a verbal encounter. And my son was like, why? And I was like, that's a great question. But then I said, you know, some of the language that was coming out of this person's mouth, because they got so mad and they started to assault us with verbal assault, using the B word, other words hurled at my wife. So, I don't know. At a certain point, you got to stand up for yourself, right? Can't just. I love what Cindy's saying. You just pay him no attention, but then you're just standing there while they're berating you and saying things that are awfully offensive. And so I say, you just stop right there. Could have been a lot worse, right? Don't start. That's nice. Don't start. I let him know. 312-981-7200. 773 says disorderly conduct would at least remove them from the environment. I know, but I think the goal here is to not put police in positions where they have to slap a pair of handcuffs on and go through the whole process of an arrest. There's a big difference between slapping somebody with a ticket and putting them in a squad car and having paperwork attached for the rest of the night for someone who was verbally harassing. But I on the surface, the free speech libertarian in me, and you know what's there, says get your hands out of my pocket and keep your hands off my free speech. But what I encountered was just harassment. And it would have followed. And if I were walking, this person would have followed me and would have gone in, you know, to where we parked in a whole bit. And if I wasn't more street savvy, and I don't think that I am, but I'm not that, I'm aware of my surroundings. I knew where I was. I knew what I was doing there. But some people who may be coming down to go to one of those fine dining establishments on Hubbard Street, they may think, what a great city. This is amazing. I live on the north side. I live in the suburbs. I live somewhere else. I'm down here. I'm giving this city a ton of money, but that was such a great meal. It was a great club, great dance moves. I'm going to walk back to my car now, and someone harasses them all the way back to the car, that's not a good look for anybody. And I think with Alderman Riley, who I know, I've seen Alderman Riley on Hubbard Street, you know, out at Boss Bar or something like that, he probably sees it firsthand. And he's had enough people complain about it over and over and over in downtown who live there, who maybe just pop out to go to the 7-Eleven, that something needs to be done to stop an uncivil society. We used to just monitor because we all were like, be cool. We're on the be cool meter. And there was this unwritten rule that, especially if you were asking for spare change or money, if the person doesn't have it, or the person does, that's the end of the transaction. But if you're going to continue or follow up with rage, say some pretty nasty stuff to the person who didn't have money, in that case, I didn't have any money on me, then is there any chance that that's illegal? That's what Alderman Riley's suggesting. I think I'm not necessarily against this. 847 says, that'll clean up Sox Park, Wrigley and Soldier Field with all the trash talking, Cardinals, Cubs fans. I thought about that. A lot of sports people yelling at each other. Doesn't this speak to free speech? And if upheld, what is next that you're not illegally allowed to say, says 630. It's great. 847 Mary says, I totally agree with this problem because it's scary to be harassed, and I could see how Alderman Riley's main intention is the ordinance to be a deterrent. But just like the death penalty, it seems like it would have a deterrent. It wouldn't have a deterrent effect. Most people who are in desperate economic situation will probably do, disregard this, and not worry about the potential consequences. I've never been in that situation, but I don't think they would stop harassing because of potential consequence. That's a great point. 312-981-7200. Six Rios says, how many tickets do you give before you make an arrest? Yeah. Great points. And I wonder what will happen. We'll see. 815 says, I was harassed because I was wearing a hostess sweater. Does that count? Maybe it does. All right, we'll take a break here. And Cassie Walker-Burke's going to come up. She's the managing editor over at Chalk Beat Chicago. She is going to join us to talk about this. What came out of the budget address, which was completely overshadowed by Blagojevich's press conference. But the tale of two budgets and why educators in Illinois are miffed. That conversation coming up next here on 720 WGN. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Justin Kaufman with you here till 11 o'clock tonight. Yesterday's budget address down in Springfield, of course, got the attention of lawmakers and people who watch state budgets, but it was Blagojevich who stole the show with his press conference he did on the porch of his home. But in it, and today we're seeing more that's coming out as, especially when it pertains to the idea of two budgets. Essentially what Governor Pritzker did yesterday is he said he put together two different proposals. One that would be a fully funded proposal if the graduated tax revenue, the graduated tax passed on the ballot coming up in November. And that would include revenue from that, and therefore this is what it would look like if it passed. If it doesn't pass, here's a doomsday scenario which had limited resources and cuts to everything across the board, including education. Educators are a little miffed because we should, and I don't know a lot about this. My next guest does. And I'm going to bring her in. Cassie Walker-Burke is with Chalk Beat Chicago. She joins us all the time. Cassie, great to talk to you.
Thanks, Justin.
Okay, so first off, I want to just clear it up because before we get into just the politics, this whole thing, last year and the year before, the headlines were dominated by the state of Illinois changing the education formula and that they had worked it out that they were going to give more money to schools. Is that correct?
That's right. So about 3 years ago, Illinois made a deal. Basically, Illinois lawmakers made this big deal, and they decided to revamp the way the state funds schools. Now, this only happens in any state every 20 to 30 years. So it's a really big thing that happened. And they went from being the most regressive state in the country. So what that means is the biggest gap in spending between low-income districts and high-income districts. We had the biggest gap of any state in the union. So the goal was to try to have more equitable spending from the state level. And part of that deal was that each year, Illinois would put more money into schools than it had the year before. And they set a target. And essentially what happened this week is that Pritzker, you know, Governor Pritzker basically said, hey, I'm going to hold back some of this money unless this tax passes. And if the tax does not pass, Illinois won't make its target.
Hmm. And because the Illinois State Board of Ed, they had asked for, what, $510 million more?
Right.
And that's what they said they wanted. And in the even if you look at the fully funded budget, it's not close to that.
Right. So, and keep in mind, so the state school board asked for about $510 million to go into this formula. And this formula basically decides how much money goes to each of the districts in the state. And so that was actually a fairly middle of the road ask. There's some education advocates that have crunched the numbers, so budget and tax accountability folks, who said the state should actually be putting more like $600 or $700 million more into schools to meet this target across time. Because again, remember, we've been underfunding schools for years here in Illinois, and so this is a way to catch up. So Pritzker's saying, coming in and saying, well, I'm going to fund even the minimum at $350 would have still been a letdown.
Right.
But the surprise here was that he's essentially not even funding the $350 million for sure. He's funding part of that, and then if the state, the progressive income tax passes, he'll put in the full $350.
And so this is a big deal, because and Republicans called it out today, saying it was shameful. They're essentially extortion or holding back. This is shakedown. The idea that this shouldn't be funds that we play with. We just did this whole formula, as you just mentioned. This is not political. You should not be holding it back so you can get a tax passed from the voters.
Right. So keep in mind, when this funding reform was passed in 2017, it was actually a bipartisan effort. So this was one of these rare moments of agreement that Democrats and Republicans in the state all agreed on, or mostly agreed on, right? We don't all agree on anything.
Right.
But, and so for a Democratic governor to then say, wait, I'm actually, just kidding, going to set some of this aside until this tax comes through, that's why people are so mad. And the other reason why, if you talk to school district leaders, why they're upset, is that we won't know the outcome of the tax until November. And so even though this money is being held in reserves, school districts can't plan. And when do school districts hire? They hire in like the spring and the summer. And so they actually can't fully plan for the next school year. And so it actually sets up many districts in Illinois into this uncomfortable position of not knowing exactly how many people they can plan for until the middle part of the year. And it's just not a good position to be in.
And Cassie, this was the whole reason of redoing the formula in the first place, so we wouldn't have these moments where we weren't sure what the funding was going to be from Springfield. We weren't sure what the money was going to be, and it would continually put school districts all across the state in flux.
Exactly. We were in flux year to year. We didn't know what to plan for. And keep in mind that in Illinois, we're still funding a lot of our school, you know, our public education through property taxes. What has happened in a Rust Belt state? We've seen, you know, there's some counties where you've seen, you know, far fewer, a lot less money coming in that way. There are places that have a lot less revenue and property tax. And so this is a way to try to distribute the pie a little bit better.
Did the Pritzker administration, did they recognize there'd be this kind of pushback? Because I understand a political idea that they're essentially using, as Republicans have pointed out, they have said this is essentially a marketing scheme to get voters to vote for a progressive tax, because we have to vote on the ballot for that to pass. And essentially for a governor to say, I'm gonna have a second budget just in case it doesn't, and that's a terrible budget, so you better take the better one. Did he realize that there'd be this much pushback, not just from the other political party, but from educators in the state?
I can't speak for the Pritzker administration, and I'm not inside, you know, those decision-making rooms, but what I can say is that it does seem like, from the people I've spoken to, that this is viewed as a very shrewd political move. So this is obviously children, something people care about. It's obviously now going to be in the top of mind. The unions are weighing in. We heard from both the state union, which represents about 200 locals, and also the Chicago Teachers Union, that they're going to be making an effort to get people out to vote for this tax. And so I do think that there's going to be more attention from education circles now that so much depends on it.
Cassie Walker-Burke is the managing editor over at Chalkbeat Chicago, which is a great site that covers all things education. There, as we look at this, it's obviously these are just proposals, but it's a Democratic-run state house, and of course a house in the Senate there. I mean, this is, was this a done deal? I mean, is this going to be the kind of way we're going to have to go into the summer when it comes to what we think the budgets are going to be?
Well, some lawmakers are already saying that they're going to push back. So I think it will be interesting to watch. Some Democratic lawmakers are saying that. So it's going to be interesting to watch. It does have to go through the legislature before it actually becomes a real spending plan.
Right. And at the end of the day, when you look at the educators and the educators you've talked to, do they see this? I mean, because I would assume that they consider the Pritzker administration to be allies, because he spent a lot of time on his campaign trail talking about investing in education and even everything from K through 12 to pre-K and everything in between. I would assume that they're scratching their head at this kind of shrewd political move.
I've heard a whole spectrum of reaction. There's definitely some district leaders and definitely some advocates who are saying that they see this as a long game, and that they think, you know, ultimately students will get more money in the long run if the state has more revenue to work with. And so, you know, there's definitely a spectrum of reaction. I wouldn't say that everyone is, you know, as disappointed, but there are certainly folks in some quarters that are disappointed with this outcome.
And not to mention that there was monies that were allocated for colleges and universities. Those were affected as well in the doomsday budget.
Exactly. So there's money in reserves now. So it's only going to come out if this proposed progressive income tax passes for both community colleges and for higher ed. And those are other areas that we've seen a sore need for more funding. Hmm.
Well, it's interesting, and it's a political move for sure. Cassie Walker-Burke covers education for Chalkbeat Chicago, a great site. Check it out. And, Cassie, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
All right. There you go. Yeah, I don't know what to make of it. I would love to talk about this if you want to talk about it. 312-981-7200. On one hand, it feels very 2015. In the way that we had Governor Rauner, who wanted to approach budgeting in the same kind of way. If you don't do this, if you don't change the way we do work with the unions, or we change the way that things are done in Springfield, I'm not going to give social services any of this revenue. It seems strange to me that Governor Pritzker, who ran as an anti or antithesis to Governor Rauner, would essentially do the same thing. Ted, what do you think? Am I reading this right? Are you as concerned as I am?
Yeah, I'm concerned in a whole lot of respects. I mean, I get it. You know, we gotta make sure that we can do this funding for whatever the vote was, you know, to make sure these school districts are taken care of. But the thing that always happens in this state, every time, we always got to have more tax dollars, but nobody ever talks about how we can figure out how to spend less.
Yeah. The spending is weird in this one, too. The budget that would be fully balanced and including the progressive income tax still asks for a large increase in revenue expenses. It's interesting,
And here's the flip side. Here's the other side of that I think I don't know why this doesn't get paid attention to either, is that we already have a problem with people leaving the state. And I know, I mean, just while I was just waiting to talk to you, I could think to myself, I've talked to no fewer than four people, four different families, that sometime within the next 3 to 5, maybe 6 years, won't be in this state, you know, because they're going to retire. Their kids have already moved out of state, other jobs. And so now that burden's on even fewer and fewer people. And I mean, we're heading down a road that you can't reverse back out of if you're going to keep going.
Let me ask you this, though, Ted, and then I'll let you go. But, you know, do you like the idea, if the governor needs to crack open the state constitution, to do that, he has to go to the ballot box. We have to, as Illinoisans, say, yes, you can. You can approve this tax. Would you do that if it meant that all of the funding that we need for schools, for parks, for roads, for everything else in between would be in it?
You know, I'm not that well versed on how that goes when it comes to the people to vote for, but I stick to the original thing I said is sure. That we're always trying to figure out how to take more out of the pockets. You never figure out how to sew up the end where we're spending it all out.
Yeah.
You know, I got friends that are teachers, and you know they get hired and they get fired and you know or get let go because you know we got to make budgets and they look to get rehired and so that messes with them too. But we got problems in the state. We just can't keep taxing our way out of.
Yeah. Thanks, Ted. Thanks for the combo. Appreciate it. 708 says blackmail. The other 708 says, well, I'll leave this state if this tax goes through. But Melissa, what do you think? Melissa, are you for the tax?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. Why? But what do you, I've been on record and on this program saying I'm for it as well, only because I feel like something we have to find ways for new revenue. But what do you think of this tactic? What do you think of the two different budgets and essentially showing you if you don't pass it, then you won't get education funding?
I think it's just reality. Mm-hmm. And I think it's only fair that the governor presents reality to the voters.
Yeah, and you don't agree with the Republicans who say that it's just political theater?
Oh, all politics is political theater, actually.
That's right. Thanks, Melissa. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
She's right. You're kind of open. She's right. She may have put the bow on that segment. All politics, political theater. 312-981-7200. We'll take a break here. Come back. We could continue this conversation. And really, just a question. Are you going to vote for this thing? Because the governor made his case in the budget address. He gave you two different options. So does that sway your vote like Melissa? Or you say, hey, listen, we need it. Or are you saying, no. Not until I see the commercials. 720 WGN. 312-981-7200. We're talking about I guess the budget address yesterday, which Governor Pritzker announced and delivered two budget proposals. One that would feature revenue from his graduated income tax, which is going to be on the ballot in November. And another that would not, to show how important it is that you vote for this change in the tax law. Some are saying, great, that's reality. Some are saying, whoa, are you holding hostage some of the revenue and expenses and some of the things that we need to do in the state? 630 says, I don't see it as a hostage situation, as so many, especially the educators, have been saying. To me, it looks more like Pritzker's telling us we can't have our cake and eat it too. And not expect to pay for it. The bigger picture is how can we continue to allow our legislators to spend money on anything, not just educational social services, that the state does not have. And I think that's his point, right? That's Pritzker's point, giving you a clearer picture. Keith, what do you think of this, Keith?
Yes.
Yeah. What do you think of this? Are you for or against the idea of two budgets?
I'm very against it. This governor, much like the last governor, now is holding non-for-profits under the last governor. Those are the 10% of the people that didn't get their money in the last budget, all those years of budget crisis.
Right.
And now we're doing the same thing to the teachers. There's a bipartisan group that came together and came up with a new funding method that was going to work, and now he's using that as a political tool to get his graduated income tax done.
Yeah.
But yet there's been no discussion whatsoever of pension reform and some of the other key things that we need to do in the state in order to get back on a good fiscal
ground.
And we are one of the highest tax states in the country.
Yeah. Thanks, Keith. Yeah, I'm for, and I've said this before, and a lot of it is just for good talk show fodder, because you guys get so mad at me about this. But I am for the governor and the Democratic Party finding new ways to find new revenue streams. What's the problem with that? What's the problem with that, Pat?
There's a lot of problems with that. Finding new revenue streams. First of all, you got to patch up all the holes that you've made in the spending.
Yeah. Okay. So
look at all
that.
Wait, no, they're not. They're not. Look at all this. They doubled the gas tax. Where's that money going?
Well, it's supposed to go to roads, right? That's the idea. They're supposed to go to infrastructure.
It's supposed to. Here's what happens. It's an impress fund. Mm-hmm. They fund that account. Okay, the road account. Then they said, oh, we got $100 million extra in the road fund account. So they'll put that money into that account with the right hand and pull it out with the left hand and use it for whatever they're doing.
Right. Taco parties.
But, yeah, but the best tax rate to have is a flat rate tax.
Yeah, we've had a flat rate, though. It didn't work. I mean, they need more, so the graduated income tax is going to project more money.
They got to cut their spending. That's the whole problem. They won't cut their spending.
They'll say, Pat, to give them credit, not both Republicans and Democrats, that we're at a certain point where there's not a lot to cut, and if you want to live in a state that provides the services they do, we have to find new revenue streams.
They've got a new revenue stream. They got weed.
Right.
They've got the gas tax. That's their new revenue stream.
Right.
Okay?
Okay.
Now, do you see, okay, we got a graduated income tax with the federal government. Do you see them balancing the budget? No.
No.
And I'm telling you what, more people are going to be leaving the state, and once you allow them to have that graduated income tax, it's going to be like the federal government. If you make $15,000, you pay this. If you make $15,300, you pay that.
Right.
And so on and so on. You're going to have more people fleeing than you can shake a stick
maybe,
at.
Maybe. That seems to be the ish. Thanks, Pat. Chuck, what do you think of this this idea of two budgets?
I think it's strictly tax extortion.
Yeah.
There's an empty cell out in Colorado. All they have to do is take the trailer out and it'll be just right for our governor.
There you go. Okay. Yeah, you're right. Tax extortion. That I'm with you. I'm not a fan of the two budgets. And, you know, this kind of stems from what we talked about on this program maybe a couple weeks ago about will it be disingenuous for the governor? Y'all weighed in at that time. Would it be disingenuous for him to come forward with a budget that was balanced, that would include a tax that needed to be voted on Election Day? We all said, yeah, right? So he came and brought you two. One that said, this is what I want. This has the right number of expense line items. It has the right number of revenue. And we will have a balanced budget with this. If voters reject the graduated tax, then we won't have enough money, so we can't pay this, this, and this, and this. I get the idea in principle. I think it's a little too theatrical in execution. 312-981-7200. 708. By the way, did Blago remind us of the pension holidays that helped put the state further in the hole when he was doing his welcome home speech? I missed that part. It might have been in one of those poems. I think when he was doing the poems, tell us about how he read so much in prison. I think he mentioned the pension holidays. It could be wrong. I'll have to listen to the tape. Let me quickly listen. No, he didn't. That's right. You nailed it. I love talking to you guys about this stuff. I really do. Coming up, let's talk about journalism. You see the story today that City Council wants to bring Alden Global Capital, the new, I guess, the majority stake owners of the Chicago Tribune, in front of them for a panel to see if they are investing in journalism, local journalism, or if they're just trying to tear the Tribune apart. Talk about that and other issues when it comes to journalism. The Journalism Town Hall coming to downtown Chicago this weekend. That conversation coming up next here on 720 WGN. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Justin Kaufman here with you on 720 WGN till 11 o'clock tonight. Last hour, we talked about Governor Pritzker and the dual budgets and what it means for education. And coming up in the next hour, we're going to talk with Ozzie Guillen, the former manager for the Chicago White Sox, world champion ring, the whole bit. Talk about him. We'll talk with him and his son, Ozzie Jr., about a podcast they just that the Guillen family
they coming in.
Yep, Bein Guillen is the name of the podcast. Bein Guillen. So Ozzie Guillen and Ozzie Guillen Jr. in studio coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. The Chicago Journalism Town Hall is reconvening. So 11 years ago, and I'll let Ken Davis tell the story. But 11 years ago. Was the first Chicago Journalism Town Hall. Brought together people from TV, radio, from print, from the internet, all come together to talk about the issues that were facing journalism. 11 years later, what did we learn? Did it play out the way we thought it was 10 years ago? Is this a reconvening of the ringing of the emergency bell that journalism is going in the wrong direction? The Journalism Town Hall is reconvening this Sunday at 1 o'clock. Over at the, where is that at?
Allegro.
Allegro Hotel, downtown Chicago. There's going to be everybody from pretty much every shop in Chicago will be represented at this thing to talk about the issues that are facing journalism, hosted by Ken Davis and Heather Sharone. Ken Davis, of course, the great host of the former great show.
Former great.
Chicago Newsroom. And then also Heather Sharone, who is the managing editor
current
of the Daily
great.
Line, who also comes on this program every Wednesday. So great to see you in studio.
Happy to be here.
So you guys are
I
the co-hosts.
I feel like I'm doing
this.
Mincing Rascals or something.
That's right. That's right. All right. So Ken, let's start this. You and Linda Paul, were you behind the idea of the original Chicago Journalism Town Hall? Why did you put that together 11 years ago?
Well, it's weird to think about it now when you think back on it, but 11 years ago, serious people were saying that the printed newspapers in Chicago had maybe 2 years to go. Tribune and the Sun-Times were they were the end of the rope. They were going to be gone, and that we were going to have to rely on online sources, and they were not really ready. They were not ready for prime time, and we weren't sure that was true, but we convened this huge panel of 12 people, and we just barely got the conversation going. And I remember I was asking, well, let's talk about the online entities and what your business model is. And John Calloway, may he rest in peace, who was on the panel, just kind of leaned into the microphone and said, their business model is theft. Because that was the
aggregates of the time. Right?
Yeah, yeah. Right. I mean, it's like we slave, work our fingers to the bone to write a story. We put it in our newspaper, and you take it and cut it up, put your own name on it, and then try to sell it to the
public. This event took on a life of its own even after the fact, because a lot of people saw that as a point where many of the online shops and the print shops weren't talking to each other.
No.
They were both with a TV station. No one was actually having a conversation. And at that point, you saw different generations of journalists come together, and it is referenced as a flashpoint to what has happened over the last 10 years.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look at the, and Heather, you can jump in here. Please don't let me. I get kind of worked up about this, you know. If you look at the legacy shops in print, radio, television, 10 years ago, they were aware that this thing was coming. I always like to say that it's a freight train coming at you at about 15 miles an hour, right? You get plenty of time to get out of the way if you plan for it, but you could also just sit there on the tracks and let it hit you. And that's kind of where things were going here. And there was a real, not only just a fear of the online thing, it was a real resentment of it. And that's where it was at that time, and we found when we started the conversation, we had this intense debate between the younger people and the older people. There was a wall at around 30 years of age, and the people who were younger were essentially saying to the people who were older, this really isn't a problem. Yeah. If you guys will just die, we will be able to do this properly.
Heather Sharone is the co-host of the Journalism Town Hall. Why do you get involved with this? Why is it important to you to have this conversation with all the journalists in the room?
So I think that our industry is at a crucial moment. I think that the tipping point toward online journalism has tipped. I don't know if it had 10 years ago, but it certainly has now. And 10 years ago, Twitter wasn't a thing. Facebook wasn't really a thing. So that has changed the landscape even more. And I think it's increased those concerns about what John Calloway, may rest in peace, said about theft. Because if you ask people younger than me, and you ask, well, where do you get your news? Too often they say Google or Twitter. or Facebook. And of course, Twitter or Google or Facebook doesn't actually produce the news. So how do we convince those people who don't realize they're reading a Daily Line story or a Block Club Chicago story or a Chicago Tribune story that they need to actually subscribe to the Chicago Tribune?
Let me do this. I'm going to take a break here so we have more time, but let me ask the audience, 312-981-7200. We can pepper this in throughout the conversation. Where do you get your news?
Mm-hmm.
Today, in this age, are you still someone who gets the paper that's delivered to your home, picks it up at the stand? Are you someone who is strictly online, who goes to different sources that are not the traditional sources? 312.
And do you pay for it?
And do you pay for it? 312-981-7200. That's the question tonight. Ken Davis and Heather Sharon are in studio. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and talk more about the Journalism Town Hall coming up on Sunday. Stay with us. 720 WGN Radio here. Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock. Ken Davis and Heather Sharon are in studio with me. 708 says, I get my news from the WGN app and watching Channel 9 News in the morning. I'm 630 says, I'm 52. I get the paper delivered. I like to actually have the paper, the actual paper to go through.
Bless him.
Yep. And 224 says, news, Yahoo homepage, cost zero.
Yep.
So there you go.
That's the issue.
Yep, we're talking to
the journalist. There's no such thing as zero.
And there's no such thing as zero. Ken Davis and Heather Sharon are my guests in studio. They are the hosts, co-hosts of the Chicago Journalism Town Hall, which will be taking place at the Allegro Hotel coming up on Sunday, 1 o'clock. This is bringing together all sorts of Chicago journalists from all the shops to talk about the pressing issues that are facing this industry. Now, today, or yesterday, City Council said, we want Alden Global Capital, the group that has bought is the majority shareholders for the Chicago Tribune, in front of us to talk about whether or not you're scrapping it for parts.
Well, it was just one alderman. It was Alderman Matt O'Shea who filed this request to have them come in front of the City Council to have a hearing. But I think it was a sign that the City Council, at least a few of them, see this as an existential threat to the Tribune.
You're rarely going to see City Council get involved in any sort of private business, especially media, to get the media company owners in front of them. So that you're right. It is a sign of what people outside of the business are thinking is happening.
Well, I think, you know, the issue with the Tribune and with Alden Global is just so universal at this point. And I saw a story that I passed around from the New York Times about Alden Global and how they killed Payless Shoes. Now, that you think that sounds like a joke, but it was a long, detailed story about how they took a very successful mall store with 1,000 mm-hmm. stores and something. And within a couple of years, they had it in bankruptcy. They just stopped investing in it, and they just let it die. This is the same company that's buying one of America's great newspapers. There's just something not kosher about this. And what I think it shows you is it's kind of like in the animal kingdom. You know, you see when there's a wounded animal out there, the vultures all.
So you
circle
say, you say
it.
Media in general is the wounded animal.
Well, yeah, as it is. And, you know, the Tribune is having its difficulties. And obviously, printed newspapers in Chicago are having their problems. They have for a long time. But I guess the thing that's really critical to all of this, though, Justin, is this thing about, are you going to pay? Because there's a survey, I think Knight did a survey that just came out a couple days ago. 16% of Americans report that they pay someone to give them local news. Now, we're not talking about covering, you know, Elizabeth Warren or something. We're talking about people who are willing to pay to get that news mm-hmm. in about their neighborhood, about their city.
Just 16%.
Yeah, 16% of Americans. So this is what we're up against. And this idea that the gentleman who called in who said, yeah, I get my news from Yahoo because it's free. One of the things at the first town hall was that there were a number of people there who were spouting this thing about what you old folks don't understand is that news wants to be free. News demands to be free. Well, yeah, except that somehow or other news has to get to you and somebody has to prepare it. Now, we're also in a kind of era now where we think people don't need to prepare news for us, that it just kind of it happens and then there it is on your phone, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Northwestern and I was actually in the very first news and new media class, which pegs me as older than I should probably admit in polite company. But in that class, there was no discussion of how do we translate these subscriptions that we rely on into how do we get that money when we give away all of our content on the web? Because the gentleman who goes to Yahoo is acting rationally, right? That's not costing him a dime. However, he's paying in ways that I don't think he realizes, right, and that I don't think we as a society have sort of dealt with, is that if you accept not paying anything for that news, that what you're getting is essentially worthless drivel. And I mean no disrespect to Yahoo. I know they're very concerned about my opinion of them. But the question is how do we remind people that news has a value, it has a critical value in our democracy, and that it is worth paying for?
Do you think that a lot of the audience, and I find myself falling in this category as I prepare for this show, a lot of times I'll run into a paywall that I have no interest in paying, right, whether it might be just because I want to look at a story about retail and it's in Forbes or Wall Street Journal or something. I'm like, I'm not going through the whole thing. I always, though, feel that my participation in that story, clicking on that and doing it, is someone's getting paid, meaning advertising is there, other things are there, that just my eyeballs alone is enough to justify looking at this for free.
Well,
is that wrong?
Now let's look for a minute, though. Let's go back to the golden years of newspapering 20 years ago, or whenever it was. You paid for your newspaper, but that really was just barely maybe paying for running the presses. I mean, what was paying the newspaper and what was paying all their staffs and their international correspondents and their air travel and everything else was the lavish amount of advertising they were able to sell. So newspapers are getting it from both ends. They're losing subscribers, but they're also losing advertisers because advertisers find it's more efficient to advertise on Facebook or online.
And Heather, this is something we've talked about too, just this idea that, you know, for all of the online, for John Calaway, who was saying at the time, this is theft, the newspaper industry, the media industry, is not competing against itself anymore. It used to be a healthy competition between the Sun-Times and the Tribune. Now you're finding your competitions with Google searches or Facebook or Twitter and social media, where that's where advertisers are going. So it's competition for the advertiser. They're no longer putting ads in the Tribune. They'd rather put it on you searching for the Chicago Tribune, which is a Google ad.
That's right. And the issue is as those dollars have shrunk, news staffs have shrunk, but I think the issue with Alden Capital is of a different magnitude, because it's not as if the Tribune isn't producing good work. It is. It's not as if it's not profitable.
It is.
But it's just not profitable enough for a giant hedge fund. So we have to keep in mind, because I think at some point it becomes this sort of self-fulfilling, self-defeating prophecy where we say, it's all terrible, you know, it's a crisis, everything's awful, but there, you know, there are solutions. There are ways that we can say, if you care about this, there's a way for you to support us. And it's not necessarily having to be a huge amount of money every month. But what newspapers have to do and what news organizations have to do is we have to offer people something of value.
Right.
You are not going to want to pony up to read the latest person arrested in shots fired breaking news. That certainly has a place, but you might not find that of enough value.
Right. Let's go to the phones. I want to bring some people in. Jefferson. Jefferson's one of our longtime listeners. Jefferson, do you subscribe to get your news?
Absolutely. Sun-Times, electronic print, Tribune, electronic, Barron's, print, Wall Street Journal.
Okay, Jefferson,
I don't work for free, Justin, and I know that you probably don't either.
Right.
Jefferson just made my day.
I can tell you one thing. One of the reasons why I do the Sun-Times, especially, I mean, I hate their editorial page. They're extremely leftist, but I love Tim Novak, and working for a city agency, I love the investigative reporting, and that's the reason that paper in particular gets my money. But I can tell you that, you know, private equity or hedge fund or whoever these guys are that got their hands into the Tribune, if they want to get rid of folks like Zorn or Rex Hupke or Darlene Glanton, I'm all for it. I'm tired of the anti-Trump talk about drivel. Okay, that's well, all the, it, every day.
You know what, Jefferson.
Every day.
So I'm giving you a pass. This is actually a really good point that he's making, because in the olden days, you know, back in like the 1980s, there was a news operation and then there was an editorial board operation, and they were very, very separate. And you might have somebody like Eric Zorin, who is a fine columnist, writing for the editorial page and sort of writing about opinions, when you might have somebody like Tim Novak writing for the news pages. And what has happened in social media is that they get sort of smushed together under
Washington
that
Post
same,
is a great example
same
of that, right.
banner of just the Chicago Tribune, whereas, you know, Eric Zorin would never have anything to do with somebody like Rick Pearson, what he's doing on the news side of things. So they're very separate, but it merges in people's
heads. And they're separate by design.
Yes.
The Tribune, the system is set, has them separate. Yeah. That with the platform is not. And we've seen this, and this is an issue that was not an issue back in 2009.
Yes.
This idea of all of it being in one platform, and the people not unlike Jefferson or others in the political sphere to be able to call it fake or to call this his opinion or to be able to demonize the news and almost blur those lines on purpose for their own needs, but the idea being that those lines that has to be brought up in this time.
Well, everything now is, as you say, it's a flat table. Everything is the same platform, and there is very little differentiation. You know, it's an interesting thing that in 2009, I think the iPad had just been introduced. It was just a complete novelty at the time. You know, phones were around, smartphones were around, but most of us were walking around with flip phones at the time. That's how things have changed in just 10 years. But what's changed in the culture is just almost not measurable. The way that we rely on that as, and we think of it as our source of news when it is not. It's just simply a delivery method.
Ken Davis and Heather Sharon are the hosts of the Chicago Journalism Town Hall, which you can find info and tickets at chicagojournalismtownhall.org. It is coming up on Sunday at 1 p.m. at the Allegro Hotel. We'll take a quick break here, and we will come back and continue this conversation at 720 WGN. So stay with us. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Justin Kaufman here till 11 o'clock. Ken Davis and Heather Sharon are here. They're the co-hosts of the Chicago Journalism Town Hall, which will be happening this Sunday. You saw all the news about it this week. It's going to be Sunday at 1 o'clock at Hotel Allegro, which is downtown. And you can get information and tickets and all that jazz over at chicagojournalismtownhall.org.
Yes.
All right, so let's get continuous, because someone put up a great text. I want to get back to it here, saying 773 says, the last few comments before the break, the crux of the situation. News at one point was news, and opinion was opinion. Now it seems like not only with the platform, but even with the reporting that is injected into it, that the what we know to be news has changed. Do you agree with that sentiment?
No, I don't.
You think
I don't
that
think
that's,
I do either.
Yeah.
I don't think I do either. And you know, it's one of the things that I think maybe has led us down this path is the cable news channels. I mean, you know, they've done more to polarize America than anything. I'm just as guilty as everybody. I watch it a lot. And where is the reporting as opposed to where's the opinion there? It's impossible to tell. The early days of CNN, where it was actually a news network. They actually had news correspondents around the world reporting the news. Now you just have bloviators sitting at a table. Some of it's very entertaining to watch, but it's not exactly what I'd call news.
Right.
So what I find interesting is that I think that news organizations, especially in Chicago but nationwide, have made a real amount of progress in incorporating non-white male reporters and non-white male points of views in their stories. And for better or for worse, when people are confronted with facts that they are uncomfortable with or that they don't have any experience with, they tend to label those as opinions when they are actually facts. And I think that this is not something that is, you know, just started happening in 2016. I think it's been happening for a long time. But, you know, the other thing that social media and digital journalism has done is that it has made it possible for you to read all sorts of different news organizations with two clicks, essentially. Yes. So you might not, 10 years ago, have been able to read the Washington Post easily on a daily basis, the way that I can every morning. And they send it directly into my inbox. I literally have to extend no effort.
I wonder, though, at the end of the day, what 773 is talking about is not unlike what you're talking about, Ken, because I think the world we live in being divided between cable talk shows is also on the web. And it's also, if your opinions are liberal or conservative, you can find organizations that are very healthy that only, they own, that's there to stock and trade.
Yeah.
They're on purpose trying to make it only about your side. We live in silos. Social media has done that to us as well.
And you don't have to do it to you don't have to do it yourself. It happens for you. The algorithms do it for you. My Facebook feed is just filled with people who pretty much agree with everything that, well, we all agree with one another, right?
Right.
I rarely get a really good argument going on Facebook with somebody who just has a completely different point of view because Facebook doesn't even want it. They don't want to waste time connecting me to them.
Isn't that interesting, though? I wonder, social media and places like Facebook, who are in a way mimicking, they're not necessarily doing it, they're mimicking online journalism. They have figured out algorithms to say the audience that you want to do, if you are do a Fox News piece or you're a MSNBC piece, they know the algorithm that it, the audience is wants to read that. And I think it reinforces the silos and the situation, makes your job much harder, like in the sense that those social media sites do not care about fair and balance or objectivity. They care about getting to the right people at the right time.
Well, this is my Callaway moment. It's laziness. That's what it is. It's just downright laziness. They don't, they out there, they're perfectly happy to feed all of us the stuff that they know we want to hear because it's like candy.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also human nature. If you read something that you agree with that, you know, reinforces your point of view of the world, you feel good. You get a little shot of dopamine in your brain. And if you read something that challenges your worldview, you feel a little bit, you know, maybe yucky or angry. And the social media companies have figured out that those are the two ways to keep us logged on. And that is divisive by its very nature.
Go ahead, finish up.
No, I was just going to say, but that is really antithetical to what news organizations and newspapers strive to do.
They're supposed to challenge you.
Right. Like, I want you to read a story that I've written in the Daily Line and say, oh, I didn't know that. I didn't think about it in that way that I heard from that person.
All right, Brian. Brian, you're on the line. Brian, what's your thought on this?
Hey, great topic. I'm a newspaper fan. I support them at my school all the time, my kids. And I just want to piggyback off of what she just said and that previous caller in that it is the reader's responsibility to make sure that we're getting that healthy diet of opinions that we disagree with. Okay, that's what Jefferson said when we founded the country. I want you to find opinions that you disagree with. Reuben Navarette, Jonah Goldberg, and Cal Thomas lots of times write stuff that I just want to pull my hair out. But if I stick with them and read them once in a while, they'll write something that I feel compelled to write them, not an email, not a post, but a letter, and tell them, hey, that was a really great column, a really great thing you made me think about. I told the screener that I'd really love to give a present of a staunch Wall Street Journal reader a New York Times subscription and a staunch New York Times reader a Wall Street Journal subscription, because if we reversed that for a little bit and just had them read the other side, that's what made, you know, the Sun-Times and the Tribune and looking at it all that way. What did that previous caller say he wanted to do? He wanted to pull the Tribune out, have those people removed, and he wants it to read like Barron's and Wall Street. He wants it to be his philosophical cheerleader. That's not the intent, so the reader has some responsibility too.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Brian. That's such a great articulate comment for this conversation.
Can I interject one real quick? I just want to finish off a thought that we were talking about here. Heather brought up before about how the newer journalism, the online journalism, is exposing people in our community whose voices were not heard before.
Yes, yes.
And a part of the reason that's happening and a part of the mechanism that's leading us to that is that newsrooms finally are beginning to be successful at expanding the number and the kind of people that they're hiring. The diversity of newsrooms is finally beginning to
That's not driven by altruism. What that's driven by, and I've talked about this before, is that I think a newer generation of people who are coming up, and I don't know what you call them anymore, millennials, Gen Z, whatever it might be, have an expectation because of the news sources that they are now consuming that the news be diverse. Mm-hmm. That it not absolutely. Just be, we've had that hammered in our head through college classes, through, I think the Daily Show had a big part of that, as that became the way a lot of young people consume news. Mm-hmm. But the point being that there's an expectation for that. And when that's missing, it's glaring. Mm-hmm. And I think with that comes new points of view and new mm-hmm. perspectives. Right. But it's not just about, you know, all right, we got to right the wrongs of the past. I think that there are numbers and clicks behind that as well.
No, absolutely. Let's not forget that Chicago is now a third white, a third black, and a third Latino. That is, you know, an unprecedented situation in Chicago's history. It's never been as diverse mm-hmm. as it is now. And if the Tribune is going to rely and the Sun-Times is going to rely on advertising revenue and subscription revenue, you have to reach as many of those people as possible. And it's no longer possible to just write for white dudes. It's just not. And that is a new situation that we all find ourselves in.
Okay, so we've seen in the 10 years, we're talking about the Chicago Journalism Town Hall, which 11 years ago was called as almost an emergency session. All the journalists in town, from Carol Marine to John Calloway to so many people who were on online journalists at the time, young journalists, were in the room. 11 years later, they're doing it again this Sunday. Ken Davis and Heather Sharon are hosting it. It's at Hotel Allegro, ChicagoJournalismTownHall.org, right?
Yeah. I'd say we got about 30 tickets left. So
30 tickets left.
They'll probably go out tonight.
At that time, you're talking about how are we going to pay for this, everything in between. You would have not recognized how the world had changed in 11 years to how people are consuming the news and how it gets distributed.
Mm-hmm.
Back to the central point, though. Will in the next 10 years, as you guys talk about it on Sunday, will all news be behind a paywall? Will we be in a point where we have finally taken the jump and said anything that you don't get, that you get for free, is junk? And anything that is actual real journalism, not unlike when I had to get my Sun-Times for 35 cents at the, you know, or pick it up off the hill. Somebody else left it. But the idea being I had an expectation when I was a kid or when I was reading the newspaper on the train that I had to pay for it. Is that expectation going to come back?
I certainly hope so. I think that is what we as an industry have to begin to present a united front from. I don't think it helps when you have competing news organizations say, oh, but mine is free. Don't pay for that.
Right.
I can give it to you for free here. There's no quicker way to make my blood boil, because we have to, as an industry, be in this together and say what we do is valuable. We have a valuable part to play in democracy. You need to value us as you would value just a cup of coffee. Like, we're not asking you to open a vein, right? We're asking for a cocktail a month that instead you spend on a subscription someplace. Or if you're really into politics news, maybe it's a little bit more expensive for someplace like the Daily Line.
Right.
You know, or you pony up for that Wall Street Journal subscription because you're in business. But I think that what has to happen is that we have to stop apologizing, saying, sorry, you've got to pay now. Of course you have to pay. You wouldn't go into Target and say, I'd like a pop. I'm just going to grab it and walk out. You were not raised, you know, you might have been raised by wolves, but that is not, you know, how people should act.
That's the Amazon. That's the Amazon model.
Yeah.
Walk in and grab it and bring it. Ken.
To add to that, I think that that's another way where the online versus the older media are changing that, are finally changing our minds about that. We have in Chicago 4, 5, 6, maybe 10 online operations that are spectacular, that are doing really good work. I mean, Block Club comes to mind. I am such a big fan of City Bureau and what they're doing there. They're not only putting out news, but they're training people, sending people to sit in meetings and, you know, the documenters. You go on and on. But they have in their DNA the idea that you got to pay for this, because how else are we going to do this? So it might be that the proliferation of those smaller, soon to become medium shops will begin to teach people that lesson. Daily Line is doing it. Everybody's doing it. You got to.
Right. And not only that, but we're all working together where it makes sense under what I like to call coopetition. We cooperate when we can and we compete when we want to. And I think a really good example is what we've talked about on your show.
Every Wednesday, right?
The Lens on Lightfoot.
Yeah.
you know, where we're holding the mayor accountable, but we're all doing it in ways that make sense for our publication. Like Chalk Beat Chicago is focused on education issues. We're focused on issues at City Hall and of policy. Block Club, you know, we worked with them on the Neighborhood Opportunity Fund. So, you know, there used to be this sort of like death match between like the Sun-Times and the Tribune. And, you know, everybody's heard the stories about you'd quit one place and you'd be marched out by security because you, you know, didn't want the secrets to go. It doesn't, I don't think that that serves our readers, and it has to be about what serves the readers. So, you know, I like that we're all working together and that we're leveraging what we can to help the reader. That's, I think that's the wave of the future.
Let me take Carol here and then we'll take a break. And then, Carol, what do you think? How do you get your news, Carol?
I subscribe to the Sun-Times and the New York Times, but I don't have a TV, so I get a lot of news from both WGN and NPR.
No, stop at GN. You're good.
And so I'm wondering what your guests think about getting news from the radio.
Great. I mean, thanks, Carol.
WGN is great. WBEZ is great. We've partnered with WBEZ on things. You know, I think everybody should do as I do. I'm an omnivore. I will read anything. I will listen to anything. And the more diverse of a sort of a source, I think, is great, because then I think, you know, it's fun.
I think WGN and WBEZ, and we'll take a break. The one thing to pay attention to, and I think online is going through that. We've already been through the ringer when it comes to what's fact, what's news, what's opinion, what's a talk show.
Yeah, yeah.
People get mad, and they get mad at me sometimes because I'll give my opinion.
Don't
That's
get
not
mad
fact.
At Justin.
Don't
guys.
Get mad at
Justin.
Don't do it. He's
but
a nice
but
guy.
The idea being that you know there are different parts of a radio station. It'll be an entertainment program or a talk show that is just more about conversation, and then there's a newsroom. What you'll hear with Vic Vaughn coming up at 10 o'clock or at 9 o'clock or that kind of stuff. 312-981-7200 is a phone number. We're getting great stuff, and I've got a lot of texts I want to read too. Heather Sharone and Ken Davis are the co-hosts of the Chicago Journalism Town Hall, which will be down at Hotel Allegro on Sunday. It starts at 1 o'clock. You can get tickets. Ken said there's a couple left at chicagojournalismtownhall.org. We'll take a break, come back, and continue, so stay with us. We're talking Chicago journalism tonight. Chicago Journalism Town Hall is going to be on Sunday. Ken Davis and Heather Sharone are here in studios. They are both they're the co-hosts of the town hall, which will include several great Chicago journalists on the panel. I'm not going to spend too much time.
So far as to say dozens
of people.
And hundreds in the audience.
Yeah. Everyone.
Great, now I'm nervous.
Rob Feeder will be there from the Daily Herald, of course. You've got Tracy Bain from the Chicago Reader, Bruce Dole from the Tribune, Fernando Diaz from the Chicago Reporter. I mean, just Carol Marine, of course. Chris Fusco, yeah. Domiti Pongo will be there from MTV. So a lot of great people. And I feel bad I'd name everybody because there's a lot of great people that are on this list, and pretty much every organization in Chicago is represented. You know, a lot of what people are texting in are saying, I am all for subscribing. And when you look at it, you're like, well, you know, I said, is everything going to be paywall? Sun-Times is, Tribune is, New York Times is, Washington Post is, any other major city's newspaper is. So we're not that far off from all of it. Daily Lines of subscription series are the same concept. But I've seen overwhelming response in Twitter or on the text saying, yeah, is there any way that it's one-stop shopping? Are we at the point where we can figure this out so it's not a subscription to every single news organization?
This is the Holy Grail. This is something that 11 years ago was being talked about is there, you know, there was something called Kachingle that was hot 10 years ago.
Gosh,
lasted
yes.
for like a, you know, a year or something. But yes, it is the Holy Grail, and what everybody is standing by for is iTunes for news, right? And what Apple did to the
music
industry.
Yeah, right. Spotify for news,
something
would be great.
Like that, right? Where you just pay one bill a month and it's apportioned every time you use somebody's service. Now it could happen, but I'm not sure that there's enough money to be made by the people doing it that they want to do it.
We're already past that. The unfortunate thing is that a great analogy to the record industry, to music.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine if Sony Music and Universal and every other Warner Brothers, everyone else had their own. If you wanted to listen to the latest Weezer song or Beatles, whatever, you had to pay a price. Then they came along with iTunes.
Yeah.
How would you work that out?
I don't know.
You wouldn't be able to. It becomes very difficult to figure that out.
It's what we're doing with TV now, too, right?
Right.
Everybody's in their own little camp. So somehow or other, you have to repack that. And I don't know if that is actually possible, but, you know,
that's the future, right? I mean, yeah. that I would think startups and billionaires and others who might want to get into it, because frankly, right. that's going to be right. where the money's at.
There would be something. And you could also do something. Heather's talking about this incredible competition, but, you know,
co-opetition.
Co-opetition. That is a place where the giants could get together and say, let's try to do this. Let's build a mutual platform mm-hmm. where everybody goes in one door and we all are paid through by it. But up to now, nothing really
that's
worthwhile.
Gonna be my side, that's going to be my side hustle. I'm going to make it.
Nice. Yeah.
All right,
I like
Heather,
it.
So what's your thought?
Well, I was just going to say that if there's a civic-minded billionaire out there, I would suggest that perhaps this is one way to get involved. And I'm one of those people who is very skeptical about billionaire ownership. I worked for DNA Info Chicago, which was, of course, owned by Joe Ricketts, who was the proverbial civic-minded billionaire.
Until he wasn't.
Until he wasn't. And I think that shows the limits of that solution. And
we hear that all the time, Heather, civic-minded billionaire, that whether it's Tribune reporters doing op-eds saying, please, we're looking for a civic-minded billionaire to come in. And as you point out, Joe Ricketts did this.
Yeah.
I think the Tribune doesn't need to go any, or the Sun-Times need to go any further than their last owner, who was a civic-minded billionaire, Michael Farrell.
Yeah. Yeah.
This idea that one person is going to come in and save a news organization seems to be, on one hand, the saving grace, and the other, a complete nightmare.
It seems like it is a simple solution to a very complicated problem, and I am here to say it is not a solution. What newspapers and what news organizations need is the, to make a government analogy, they need a consent of the governed. If people value what we produce and pay for it, we will survive and we will be fine. Nobody's in this business to get rich. Nobody's, in this to buy palatial Winnetka mansions or anything along those lines. But the sense is that people just have to find somebody who's willing to settle for, 20% profit margins, which is what the Tribune was not too long ago. Mm. But thinking that one person, and in everybody's imagination, I assume this is a white man, right, who's got tons of money, is going to come in and solve this problem without doing the hard work of addressing where we as newspaper or news people have failed the city and where we can do better and where we can bring those people back into what we are asking them to participate in, I think is the fundamental work that has to be done.
There'd be a lot of questions and a lot of great conversation on Sunday. 312 asks, if you look in the crystal ball 10 years in, looking forward, will there be two newspapers in this town? I mean, we've heard this. We've been ringing this bell for a while.
We came so close to having no Sun-Times just a couple of years ago, and now it's turned back around, and now the Tribune's on a little bit shakier ground than the Sun-Times was. But let's not forget what saved the Sun-Times. A bunch of investors, mostly labor union-backed, that got together and said, no, we value the paper, and they said, let's just let it keep running. Now, the Sun-Times has had to deal with a fair amount of criticism that they're bankrolled by unions, and that has somehow swayed their editorial board coverage or their news coverage, which I don't believe for a second. But, it opens that lane of criticism too as well.
I would say that 10 years from now, the question of whether there will be two printed newspapers, mass newspapers in Chicago, is a kind of an irrelevant question, because something else is going to be dominant 10 years from now.
If we were here 10 years ago from now, mm-hmm. we would never have been able to predict DNA Info. We would never have been able to predict Black Club Chicago. So there's just no way for us to know what we don't know at this point.
And, we can start advertising now for the 2031.
It's got to be every 11 years, right?
Right, every 11 years.
It's a fascinating conversation, and it's going to be a great conversation for all the people that are going to be on the panel and for the two co-hosts, Ken Davis and Heather Sharone. They will be shepherding this conversation, which will be very spirited and very interesting, down at Hotel Allegro.
Our job is to try to keep a lid on it.
I was going to say, I can't promise fisticuffs, but I can't promise there won't be fisticuffs, because we all feel very passionately about that.
There may or may not be fisticuffs.
You know the story of the Walnut Room? I mean, it's like, it's such a cool place.
That's where it's going to be. Yeah.
It's where the reason we chose it the first time is because we're old enough to remember. That's where that was one of the great smoke-filled rooms where DiArco and all those guys. There's Robert Davis, who used to be the City Hall reporter, wrote a great story in 1999 called about when they rebuilt the hotel. while, talking about how DiArco had a table with, you know, in the Walnut Room with a telephone on it, and all the aldermen and the deal makers would have to come and have lunch with him there, and they'd write their names on the tablecloth. This is a storied room with a great history.
That's great. The Walnut Room at Hotel Allegro will be the site for Chicago Journalism Town Hall. ChicagoJournalismTownHall.org to get tickets. Ken Davis and Heather Sharon will be there. They'll be the co-hosts, and there's a slew of great reporters and journalists who will be there as well. Guys, thanks so much for coming in tonight. Right. I really appreciate
it. Thanks for having us.
312-981-7200. Coming up, Ozzie Guillen and Ozzie Guillen Jr. in studio to talk about their new podcast, Being Guillen. But also about the state of baseball, about Latinos in baseball, about Ozzie wanting to get back into management. With all those, during the cheating scandal, we'll talk about that as well, but with all the cheating scandal vacancies, all the managers that ended up getting fired, and who was going to replace them, isn't it fascinating that Ozzie Guillen's name did not come up in that? I'm going to ask him about it. Whether or not this is MLB has turned its back on Ozzie Guillen. We'll talk to Ozzie about that. We'll talk to him about his family being from Chicago. I can't wait. I'm a longtime White Sox fan, and Ozzie Guillen is one of my favorites. So Ozzie and his son, Ozzie Jr., are my guests coming up next here on 720 WGN. We'll get to that conversation, which will be in the 9 o'clock hour right after Vic Vaughn's news. 312-981-7200, 720 WGN. Welcome back to 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman with you. My next guests are two of the co-hosts of the video podcast, Being Guillen, which can also be seen live on La Vida Baseball Chicago on Fridays. La Vida Baseball is a site dedicated to the Latino experience in baseball, on and off the field. The co-hosts are not only capable of carrying a conversation, but they are related, father and son. Ozzie Guillen and Ozzie Guillen Jr. both have experiences in sports media, but Ozzie, of course, has spent a majority of his career on the other side of the microphone. One of the best managers to have ever managed the South Side of Chicago, not to mention played a mean shortstop for a number of years. Ozzie Guillen and Ozzie Guillen Jr., my guests tonight on WGN Radio. Great to have you guys. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
The third co-host is not here, your other son, only. What does it mean to be able to do this podcast with family?
Well, it's a three different mentality of baseball. You know, not because we grew up together in baseball, that means we have the different, you know, same opinion. You know, Olney got a different opinion, Ozzie got a different opinion, and I can look the opinions of the game different way they look at it, and that's why it makes it so much fun. We're not holding barrels, you know what I mean? I think we say what we need to say three different way.
Yeah, right.
And that's why I think it's making fun because, you know, we argument between each other.
Well,
like,
I think now they're just getting our life on the air. We talk baseball 24/7, a lot of WhatsApp messaging because the WhatsApp is like the international texting app. And since he's in Latin America a lot, we are always giving him updates. And we view the game differently, obviously, from a perspective of just how the game has changed. Not so much analytics, but again, when you've played the game that long and you've managed the game, he has a different perspective and view of it.
Right.
I'm a big fantasy baseball player. Don't consider myself an expert, but I look at things from a different perspective.
And you've covered. And I've covered shows, so
it's funny because it's the first time my brother, Oni, is on the show as well, like with us in a show, because I worked for The Score for many years with Oni as one of my partners. And then I actually covered Ozzie with the White Sox for multiple seasons. So it's funny because I had to basically say, you know, Ozzie Guillen, not my dad, because that's weird to say on the air. But he gave me actually one of the best advice. He said, don't be scared to throw me under the bus or have your opinion. And that was, you know, now I'm 35 years old. That was like 24 and super immature, I guess, when it came to that. But now it makes a lot of sense because he gave me a lot of freedom to just not worry about, you know, running out there. I think that I was like one of the, you know, living with the guy that I wanted Adam Dunn not to play because I thought rest would help him. But then living with him, being able to say that on the air and be able to take, I think that now being on the air together, we still go back and forth and agree to disagree a lot.
Ozzie, what do you learn from your sons in this? Because you could say, you could easily be a guy, you've won a world championship, you're, you know, baseball runs through your blood. You could say, yeah, I can't learn anything more about the game. But what do you learn from your son?
Everything. You know why? Because, like I say, you know what I mean? I'm not away from the game because I keep working on TV and doing baseball analysis and do all kind of stuff. But the way they look at the game and the game going on right now, I learn a lot from them. You know what I mean? Like, oh, you're right. Oh, you know how many things I say, how many times I say, oh my God, you're right. Oh my God, yes. And this game is so good because every day you learn something. Every day you got a subject to talk about, especially when the season starts. Mm-hmm. And it's not about, I told them, just make this thing fun. You're talking about this guy is a great hitter, who is the best hitter in baseball, who is the best defense. I think overall, like everything. And not because we're going to be that baseball, just it had to be in Spanish. And I told him, just do something in Spanish, because I think I had a lot of friends out there that want us to talk in Spanish, have mm-hmm. a show in Spanish. But in the meanwhile, say we think in Spanish, but we had to say the thing in English. And then that's a fun part of the
We have seen in baseball, I was kind of surprised that, because I was getting ready for this, and I was like, okay, let's talk about Latinos in baseball, of course, on the field, but also in the dugout, the managers. Because you would think with Davey Martinez being a Brooklyn-born Puerto Rican descent, and then you have Alex Cora.
Alex, yes.
Then it's you, meaning who won his World Series. I was totally surprised. You would think just from the last 2 years that every year a Latino manages a team that wins a World Series. It was just been the last 2 years, and then it goes back to you. Are Latinos thriving in the dugout? Are Latinos getting their appropriate shot to run teams in Major League Baseball?
Well, I think they look up better now. They see more Latino coaches, more Latinos in managing in the minor leagues. It's more opportunity. Now we have to take advantage. It's just because what the guy did in the past, it might open for you later on. But be honest with you, I don't see it that way. I see you give the job to the guy who deserves the job, not because you are Latino, Asian, and African-American. You should have the job because you're a minority. Mm-hmm. I think when you go to hire somebody in that particular job, it's very, very hard job to hire somebody, not because your last name is Gonzalez, you should be interviewed. You know what I mean? Right. I think you have to interview and give the opportunity to the guy you think.
Do you agree with that? Do you agree with that, Ozzie Jr.? That
he might not. He never.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I mean, the question is, are Latinos getting their fair share when it comes to being in the dugout managing teams?
I think that's my concern with Latinos is not so much the dugout managing. When you look at the numbers of teams, what are we going to say? We want 15%. 50% of the league to be Latino. I think that opportunity. I think that my issue is with providing them with the same amount of opportunity. And this is what I mean. AJ Hinch gets hired again, so should Alex Cora. You hire an old manager like George Girardi, Ozzie Guillen deserves to manage again. If, a manager like Eric Wedge, who's interviewed pretty much with everybody in Major League Baseball and managed like seven teams now, why hasn't Tony Peña had that same chance? I feel that the line for a mistake, if you're a minority, is a lot shorter than if you were not a minority. And I think that's unfair when we can go and grab someone like Aaron Boone, who's an amazing baseball guy, but bring him from no experience whatsoever and make him a manager.
David Ross, right.
David Ross, right. You know, would they do that for a Latino guy? And it's funny because here in Chicago, they're like, oh, that's like when they hired Ozzie Guillen. I'm like, no.
No,
Ozzie Guillen coached, third base coach,
and he had Cubs.
And he had coached for the Montreal Expos.
Right,
so
right.
There was 6 years of preparation.
Right.
Dave Martinez was with, Joe He's Madden right for like
Chicago,
12
yeah,
years.
Right.
So those, I think that's what I'm looking for, more of the fairness of, hey, this guy paid his dues. Why isn't he getting a shot? That's what I think, what I'm concerned with.
I want to take a quick break, and then we'll come back. Ozzie Guillen and Ozzie Guillen Jr. here talking about their podcast, Bein' Guillen, which can be heard on La Vida Baseball Chicago. It's a video podcast. You can see it on Fridays, but also you can find it on the website. We'll talk more with them just right after the break here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Welcome back to 720 WGN. My guests, Ozzie Guillen and Ozzie Guillen Jr. They are two of the three hosts of Bein' Guillen, Oney Guillen the third. You can find this video podcast at Bein' Guillen. You can find it at La Vida Baseball Chicago. We're talking about Latinos in baseball because that's really what La Vida Baseball Chicago is all about. We had some of the guys in here talking about La Vida Baseball before. It's about exploring and celebrating Latino culture in baseball, not just about the players, but about how people watch the game in different... You just said, Ozzie, that you're going around Latin America. The way different countries consume baseball is a story in itself.
Well, it was a busy winter for me. You know, Osney, or youngest one, managing in Colombia.
Right.
And it was amazing for me how people in Colombia, people, when you talk about Colombia, you talk about soccer. It's no doubt about it. You talk about soccer, or so the guy ride a bike for 17 hours in a row and winning. And it's about biking and soccer. All of a sudden, I look at it, and I see this ballpark packed every day. We're not talking about 40,000. You're talking about 7,000-8,000 people every night. And the most guy, like, you know, you see 700-800 people in the ballpark. Sound like if you had 10,000 people at the ballpark, because they get into those games and they fight. They I'm not talking about free fight. They're talking about they're screaming to each
they're
other.
Excited,
they talk about that all day. Same way in Venezuela, same way in Puerto Rico this year, Mexico, Dominican Republic. I think won the best baseball in Winter League. But when you look in the way we the flavor with the way we feel about it. And believe me, they asked me about Osney just win the Colombian League. Yeah. And they asked me about it, you know, how you feel. I said, well, it's a father. I feel more proud and I enjoy this more than when I win in Chicago. Because here's a job. Over there is a party. It's a proud thing. You know, how I win the championship last year. You know what I mean? That's a different way we look at it.
It's like national pride, right?
It's more. I managed, you know what I mean? I managed in Winter League last 3 years.
I think a lot more pressure.
A lot of pressure, you know what I mean?
For a lot less pay.
I managed in Winter League last 3 years, and to me, it was harder to manage a Winter League than managing Big League. People think I'm crazy. Oh, my God, really? Yes. Because my experience was opposite. My experience, you know, most of the managers go to manage in the big league. They already went through a minor league in Winter League. My experience from being a champion to Winter League, I said, oh, my God, I invite Dusty Baker, Joe Madden, my associate. I say, you think you guys can manage you? Come down for a month here. You got to ride the bus for 14 hours. You got one roster one day, and the next day you got different roster completely.
Why do you do it?
I love the game. Well, my friend is on the team. I want to manage the team. I always say before I retire, we'll pay back. Because my life in the game was so easy, or easier, or was lucky. Because I went from playing the minor league, go to the big league, coaching the big league, managing the big league. I never paid the price or played the dues.
Do your dues. You've always been very... You're like a savant when it comes to baseball. It comes, you know, very second nature to you.
Yeah, but it's like, oh, my God, I just got a surgery, and I ride the ball for 14 hours. You know what I mean? Like really?
No, people in Venezuela
they don't care who you are.
I was going to say, there are no private jets.
No,
we have more private jets.
Yes, we do.
Yes, we do. That's the most we have. Yeah.
That's a different category.
Different people those private jets.
Not the baseball manager.
But no. I just think that you also felt great to be back on the field. He got to manage Osney, which was pretty cool. We got to be part of like family around the game again. And, you know, the game of baseball, you know, like La Vida baseball, there's a certain style of play that I love analytics, by the way, with this next comment. But we're going so much to the we don't care about emotions, and we're becoming very robotic. Kind of personalities are out of the game. That this gives it a flavor of these players are still human beings. You know, these guys still have, you know, Joe Madden was probably one of the most interesting guys because Joe is Joe. Mm-hmm. You know, he was just like this quirky,
that's why people fell in love with the team. Even if they're not from Chicago.
Exactly. You got Ozzie Guillen that had his style, mm-hmm. and Dusty. And everyone was a great manager, but everyone had their own style. I feel now like managers are more like middle management. Like everyone just wants the monotone. And I feel like La Vida brings that back. To a sport that needs a lot of marketing, that there's players are just more than numbers, and that we want people to get to know these players. That, you know, that yes, there is Mike Trout, but there's so much more than Mike Trout. You know, Javi Baez, we're lucky in Chicago, probably one of the top five players in Chicago, playing wise, national wise, and that you can market him. You know, people want to be him, Moncada. So I think that just giving these players another platform for them to be able to express themselves to us, that was so important because. Again, people fall in love with players. They don't care where they're from.
I was going to ask about analytics when it comes to players, because we hear about it all the time when it comes to managers and how you put a team on the field. But when you have somebody who may come from Dominican Republic or Cuba or Venezuela, who is used to that La Vida style, is used to playing with passion and putting their personality first, Are they susceptible to the whims of analytics that maybe they don't see what makes them shine because they have a bad, you know?
I don't think it's their job. How does that work?
Be honest with you, I know the players coming from where we come from. I don't think they care about that because they have one thing in mind. Hit 300, win 20 games, or make a lot of money. They're not going to say how and how they get there. You just make sure they get there and stay there just to make the money and survive and be who they want to be, make sure his dream come true. So many things different than because you cannot speak to Puerto Rican player the way you speak to the Dominicans or Venezuelans or the Panamanians or, you know, all the Asians. You know, you cannot speak the same language in the guy and grew up in the South, grew up in California. That's the thing. I think if you look at the players, when you add honesty, they say, I want to have a good year. Well, first of all, the players say, we want to win the World Series. That's the first thing they ask before they sign even the contract. But how are they going to win it? They really don't care. They make sure they score one more run than the opposition and make sure they pitch well. But they know when I go, okay, that's the way we're going to do it.
How do you manage, Ozzie? And I've been a United Nations on the 2005 White Sox.
Yes.
Everybody represented. How do you manage when it's not the same language, when it's people didn't come from the same countries, same backgrounds? As a manager, and you want to bring them all together, what language do you speak? Not specifically, but what do you do to bring them together?
Well, leadership. And one language I'm going to talk is WIN, win games. I don't care how you're going to do it, how you did it in your country, how you got to here. You got to throw everything out and worry about what we're going to do this year. One day I got upset and I went into the players very well. But the players always stick up for me because they know when I say something, I meant it. Because they know I'm 100% behind them. It's one thing about it, I just want to win. And the only way I got to win is just play well for me. I was cursing them out, very upset, throwing stuff in the clubhouse. And they listened to me. And also I turned around and Tadahito Higuchi, interpreter, was next to me. I went after. I said, you told him what I'm telling people right here and everything. Ryan is a kid thing.
Ryan was a little petrified.
Ryan go.
They don't have those words in Japanese.
Ryan go, Ozzy, I don't think they have that kind of language in Japan. And I left. I left the room laughing and it was over because everybody was laughing because I was very upset about it. But as soon as he said that, I said, I cannot say this in Japanese because I don't know how.
Are we at a point now where managers have to speak Spanish?
Yes and no.
Joe Madden has
to. No, I don't think they have to because there's interpreters, which is something that Ozzy was pushing for a long time. I was the first one in for the White Sox. Now it's something that is normal and it's across. It's just a better way of communicating because if you have to pull a coach, you're taking him from doing something else. So why not have Ozzy Jr., who's not a coach, interpret and do a good job at it and have some coach work with a player in coaching? The part that analytics, going back to that point that you made, and Latino players and that, and I'm going to say even American players, no one ever plays the game for stat. Ever since you're in Little League, especially in Latin America, you're playing to win. And it's all about getting that run. You know, how do I get that one more run to beat the other team? And that's the United States, that's high school, that's Venezuela, that's Colombia, that's everywhere. And in a game in the United States, we've gone, the most important stat at the end of the day is the W and the L. Because that's what gets you your team to win or lose. And we've gone away from that of, my guys can do this, and this. Are they getting you wins? And I feel like for the players who are Latino, I think if you talk to them and say, hey, maybe if you do this, if it helps them, they'll say, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, right.
But if you're going to tell them you have to change your game because they're going to say, well, how does this make me a winner? Again, the other thing is that this is like a myth that I have. Part of what I do is work with numbers, corporate America, have an MBA. Everyone in baseball is full of it with all these managers that are saying, I'm an analytical guy.
Right.
No, you're not.
No, you're not.
You can't code. You can't write algorithm. You might know how to read the spreadsheet. And that's something that I think to me is funny because all these guys that have been in baseball for 30 years are all of a sudden analytical because they took one class one day. I'm like, no, the kid that's upstairs that's writing the algorithm, he's analytical.
That's the one, right?
I'm saying you understand it and you can have a conversation.
You may listen to the...
That can help.
It's funny because if you grew up in the game of baseball, they changed the language, okay? And now it's backed up by data. So it's like if I'm in the business world and I say, hey, this station is going to make money because it's just smart. It's like a news station and there's nobody covering news. But now I can say, hey, if I have an MBA, the profit margins are great.
Right.
And I drop some real stats. That's the same thing in baseball. Ozzy would tell you, hey, Ozzie Jr., the guy's got a great curveball. It snaps. The bat's jumping off the ball.
12-6, yeah.
12-6. Now they say, oh, it's got a good spin rate. It's same got a great line. Right. So it's the same thing. But this whole thing of like, this guy's analytical, I'm like, really? Because he's got glasses on and he's got an iPad. So it's all marketing and buzzwords.
Right.
And it's funny how he gets considered. People think that you never use numbers. I'm like, do you think this guy managed this long in the big leagues without using numbers?
Let me do this. Let me take a quick break. Ozzie Guillen Jr. Ozzie Guillen here as well. Two of the co-hosts, Oney Guillen III and Bean Guillen, which is a video podcast found on La Vida Baseball Chicago. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, continue the conversation here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Welcome back to 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, Ozzie Guillen and Ozzie Guillen Jr. talking about their podcast, Bean Guillen and La Vida Baseball Chicago. That's where you can find the podcast. Is this time of year for you, Ozzie? Do you miss it? Do you miss coaching when spring training starts and baseball's on everybody's mind?
You know what? It was through last year.
Yeah?
It was. It was hurt. I think I was my first year we now being spring training for so long. It directly hit me. And I went to Mexico. Well, we'd be around players and try to take this away from me. But, you know, besides last year, I had my granddaughter born. And sometimes like, man, I get up in the morning and say, man, I wish I'd be in the field. But sometimes I say, I'm fine. I will take care of my granddaughter. Is I miss it? Yes, yes. Obviously, I'm the baseball man. I want to be on the field. I want to be the leader in the team. But in meanwhile, like you miss something, but I don't die or miss sleep because that.
When the cheating scandals broke and managers started losing their jobs, we saw this with Alex in Boston and Carlos Beltran in New York and, of course, A.J. Hinch. I was surprised that your name was not thrown out more. I know you put out a tweet about it. It was kind of a joke. But I don't understand because you are somebody who has had a winning track record. You have been able to lead teams to the playoffs and to a world championship. Were you surprised that your name wasn't at the top of lists of the analysts that were saying who needs to come in here and fix the Astros, the Red Sox, the Mets?
Well, I think people was. I was kind of like disappointed. Like, my God, feel like I killed somebody or murdered somebody. I don't know. I feel like very weird about it. Like what I did bad in the game or what I should do to get it better. But meanwhile, like I said earlier, you got to call the people. Now when you call somebody to interview in baseball, you're calling 10, 12, 14 different people when you know who's going to be the manager.
Right.
Okay, now before you got 2, 3. Okay, I got to interview this guy and that guy and that guy and this. But now, it's so many people say, why you got to ask everyone? And everybody better come with the answer. I want to hear it.
Right.
Well, because there's no path. And I think that's the hard part because, so before, it was hard to get a shot. And you had to get 5, 6, 7 years as a coach. And then you coached and then they thought you were a good baseball guy. You might manage, then go back to coaching. And then you brought back a guy that had experience, hence Joe Torre, successful after managing for 20-something years. Now, even coaching doesn't even guarantee you that. Like, if I had to give somebody advice right now, I just told my little brother who won the Caribbean Series, doesn't have a job in minor league baseball, you better might as well go work for a hitting facility and come up with a hitting philosophy, and you might be a hitting director for a team because that's the quickest route than coaching.
Or and actually winning championships, international championships.
Exactly. Or be a consultant for a team. You know, like David, for example. Like, we all knew that he was going to be the guy. 25 years ago, they never would have thought about bringing someone from upstairs to being on the field. So for him, it was smarter to not be connected to the coaching staff for last year, which he would have made a great bench coach. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know what, I'll consult. Same thing as Craig Counsell. So being on the field now is not as important. They can grab you from TV. They can grab you from and even not even just managers, general managers. You know, they're looking for agents. And that's hard because it's like if you worked in a corporate America company and you're a CEO who's had success in a Fortune 500 company, and then there's a junior executive interviewing for the CEO position.
Right.
And you're like, that's what I'm competing against. So that's why right now in the industry it's kind of hard, kind of drawing that line. And I think it's a real hard time because you don't know who the candidate is. It could be anybody.
Ozzie, do you want to come back? Do you want to be a manager?
Yeah. Of course.
Someone calls you?
You know why? Because I'm not better in the game. I have a great life right now. I do. I'm having fun. I do a live radio. I go to do pregame and postgame with the White Sox. And I have my grandkid.
I think Adela would love to see you managing this.
Okay, you know what? It's one reason. But I think they're not going to see the Ozzy, the one who was, and people said, man, you were so wild. And so I said, no, that was the generation. I was competing against Joe Madden, Lou Piniella, Dusty Baker, Mike Socia. That was our era. Now you put me in compete, and now when the media come to you, they come hard. And they ask you a question like, what? Okay, this is the answer. Mm-hmm. It's not like, oh my God, this guy said this is, no. Nowadays, I call Chicago media the weakest media they have.
Really?
Every day, I know for a fact, because I work in the media side, and I had to talk about the interview after the game, and I write notes about, and I call them up. I say, guys, you guys weak. I call them, I got a lot of friends in the media. I say, my God, you changed. Oh, my God. Because maybe they don't care.
Right.
Or they have to be careful what they say.
Right.
Oh, because I say something about Ozzy, next day Ozzy not gonna come jump to me like, hey, you talk about me.
Well, there's concern. You're seeing this more and more, a concern about access to the team. If you say the wrong things, that the team can take away your access.
Yeah, all that kind
of stuff. So the media is in a tough spot where they can't be as critical as they once were.
Well, to me, I'm working. My job is criticize people now. And to me, when I go to, you know, obviously before I will criticize you, people are like, oh my God, now I got a different way to criticize you. And why? Explain to you very calm, and people can see me why I say, because I can talk to anybody.
But if you talk to your players, players are human beings. If Ozzy went up to the media and said, I need my guys to play better or else they're going to get in trouble, like he does on the pre and post game, they would laugh and be like, why is this guy being so fake? Like, what is he doing up there? And I think that when you're a manager, the way that he reacted was for his players to react, which they did.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's funny because everyone calls like Ozzy, like, oh, he's so wild and crazy. I think that there's a lot of like snippets and funny things that he said. And again, like, some controversial things, mm-hmm. some things that the message was right. They just didn't like the messenger. But he didn't get kicked. You didn't get kicked out as much as people think that you did.
No.
You just made the guy. I think that you made the times you got kicked out
worth it that
you got this mystique.
Okay. Ozzy, we talk about interpreters in the big league. I got in trouble big time. We Major League Baseball, I call him up, I say, why we don't have Latin interpreter? Why we not Asians interpreter? Right away, they call me like, hey, you a racist or those comments don't write for baseball? I say, wait a minute, what did you say? What's the difference between, I said it, between
right.
Tarahiro Iguchi and Vladimir Guerrero? They don't speak English. No matter where you come from, they don't. Then why we don't have that? Oh, my God, I got in trouble so bad. Now they have... Every player have interpreted now.
A lot of times, too. And you said this. You said that, you know, today's media in Chicago is weak. Was it weak when it was covering you?
No.
Back in the day, they were hard on you.
Maybe because it was my fault. But they covered. They was covering Dusty Baker, Don Baylor. They was covering Lou Piniella. You know what I mean? After that, it was a little down because, what's his name? Bojangan Cloudy? He was the third base coach. He went and then Joe. But in meanwhile, I go, you got to answer the question. One guy go to me, go, why this guy? And you say, why? Because I'm the manager. No, because you want me to. And I was scared about the media. Now you got to ask me, I will respond to you. Same stuff I want to say different way.
Right.
I'm older.
You've learned.
I'm older. I know
your English is better.
I never went out and say something. I say, no, they don't understand what I say. I don't mean it that way. I know. I step up like a man. And maybe that's why I got in trouble.
I think you had a chip on your shoulder.
Besides that, what I told Osney, you know, he's managing, I said, don't be honest.
Don't be honest. No.
Don't be honest, because honesty, first thing you ask for your mouth, you better be honest. You better be honest. Well, unfortunately, here in the United States, in baseball, I'm not going to say United States, in baseball way or life, you can be honest because, right, you will hurt somebody going to get hurt when you're honest.
Yeah.
Somebody around somewhere, you're going to get hurt about it. And that's why I told my kids, they say, hey, buddy, you want to have a job in baseball? Just sir, and move on.
Yeah.
That's the wrong way.
I got to say, it's strange because we love people to be honest, right?
Yeah.
We are straight shooters.
That's what we think.
Managers, politicians, whatever it might be, they're straight shooters. They're honest with us. They're transparent. But you're absolutely right. Honesty, that's the one thing you can't get.
Well, you can be honest when you get to the top.
Yeah, but I've done it. But I remember Kenny Williams saying me, hey, I asked a lot of people. I asked you. You went to school. I never went. I said, hey, man, what I should do this? What I should say about this? What they mean this word? I say, when you go to tweet about it, I say, hey, don't say that because they know it's not me tweeting. It's you. That's the word not coming out of Ozzie Guillen's hands because they know I'm not that smart.
Right.
But Kenny told me, say, hey, honesty is the best thing you're going to tell your players. You just be honest with. and they like it, they like it, they don't move on. Then I was honest with all my players. I was honest with anyone. I'm honest with anybody. They give me anywhere, yes. They give me what I am, who I am, what I did,
right. What
I'm doing. But meanwhile, in the game, you can be honest. Especially nowadays, like the tweeting and the Instagrams, and you know me. A couple of days ago, Manfred said something. I know for a fact. You know, meaning that way that the piece of what's in it,
the piece of metal,
the
but
piece
he
of metal.
No, which
no, but I know for a fact. People know. You don't want to say it that way. He was thinking that way. He went out that way, and he got crucified.
Mm-hmm.
Crucify.
Well, let me ask you, because it's a great transition, honestly, Ozzie Guillen Jr. here, two of the co-hosts for Bean Guillen, which can be found on La Vida Baseball Chicago podcast. That's a weekly podcast. It's live on Fridays, and you can find the video podcast on the site. Honesty is there's a big, right now, baseball has got a problem. The cheating scandal is getting bigger and bigger, mostly because the clubhouses have opened up and the players are getting pretty nasty. Every night you see a player from a different team that says something either against the Houston Astros, against the commissioner, against baseball. They're more critical than you've ever seen players. LeBron
I think
James.
I think in the history of the game.
In the history of the game.
Play association, too.
Yeah. You saw LeBron James getting into it. But what do you think about this? As two baseball guys, are you scared? Are you fearful that this is going to have a standing stain on the game? Blackjack McDowell came out and said, hey, the White Sox, La Russa was doing that.
Hey, stupid.
Stupid?
Well, I say stupid. Everybody have an opinion. Because I always told my kids and my people, say, white people don't respect my opinion. White people always against whatever I say. But face to face, I will explain to you why. Then you're like, wow, you know, you're right. But first of all, Jack wasn't there. That's the first thing. I was in Panama, I think. Ozzie Jr. called me. Oh, look at what Jack say. I started laughing because I said, no, wait a minute. Jack was here with Fregosi was here. And we went through a manager before Fregosi got the job, and I said, how he say that? But when you make those comments, and not that Jack's my boy, I love him, I respect him a lot because he's an outspoken man, since I know him, but you got to come to a fact. Some, do you know how many media call me after that? The media supposed to be the one I can trust. And I curse them out, both, anyone. You know, I can say here what I said to them. I said, you know what? If you see it, or you then yes, and one thing come around my mind. I say, wait a minute. You think I know what's coming? Being one of the best fastball hitter in the game, then I gotta hit 220, 250.
I hope they'll be embarrassed. I told him. I said, I hope it's not true because you guys did not win.
By the way,
that's embarrassing.
By the way, if we got if they had that. My God, we finish last every year.
That's
embarrassing.
That's embarrassing.
But I respect, you know, if Jack say that, hey, listen, I cannot say yes or no because you got it for a fact, but if I see it.
But it doesn't make it right. And that's the part that I think it's funny that people are saying, hey, you know, Bronk hit a home run that hurt around the world because there was a telescope in right field and knew it was coming. That does not make the fact that you were giving signs in real time using technology right.
That doesn't make it right.
That doesn't make it right that you did. So that's the part for me from a base. And it's really hard because we love, not only from being Hispanic, being Latino, for both Beltran and Alex Cora. Alex Cora is like an uncle to us.
I talked to him. I know about the problem because that's the last thing I want to do. Everybody talk about, with him, talk about that. The song I go to, he called me and go, hey, how about this? No, I don't even, I do care because Alex Cora was my boy when he won the World Series. Still my boy. I disagree with what they did. What they did, not what he did. I disagree with it. I'm against it 100%, millions of percent. But that nobody changed my friendship with Alex.
Right, right.
And that's the people, because human being, when people's down, they beat the crap out of you. Make sure you're still down.
They really
do,
don't they?
And you forgot what they did or what they do. Mm-hmm. And I say Alex or whatever, it wasn't that problem. They're right, because to me, this is worse than the PED, because when you do that, that's for your own good. But this take a lot of problem because they, you know, Joe Girardi win two World Series, he got a chance to be Hall of Fame. Now just because that, you don't have a chance to win. You know, I mean, if Joe Girardi win.
If he beats the Astros.
If he beats the Astros,
he's stays, the still stays as the coach still, of the, or the manager of the Yankees.
Yeah,
right?
Because Yankee will be like, hey, we're going to. He might say, no, you're leaving no matter what. Right. That's part of the game. Same way with Joe Maddo here. Joe Maddo, if Joe Maddo wins another World Series here, he's not being on a high right now.
No.
They will find a way to sign him back.
Right.
That's my problem. My problem is what you guys did.
It affected everybody.
What you guys did for a game, and I think I come with different ideas. But like I say, Zazi Gia say something. What? But another people say something. Hey, they listen to it. The only way this thing shut down right away is they do something to the Astros besides the $5 million in the draft. It's not. They got to continue to talk about it every day, day in and day out, because people got different opinions. People have different feelings. You ask me about it. I say, you know what? Be honest with you. I'm a baseball man. I don't care. But my wife say, okay, if that happened in 2005, and you play in Houston, that happened to you. What you be saying right now?
Right, right.
That's the biggest problem.
Right?
Yeah.
Ozzie Guillen Jr., my guest tonight at 720 WGN. Let's take a break. Stay with us. 720 WGN, Justin Kaufman here. Ozzie Guillen Jr. in studio. You know, Ozzie, you are among a very small handful of champions in Chicago. And you have been a face for the Chicago White Sox for a long time. Do you feel that? Do you feel the love that you get from White Sox fans and the fact that you are on the Mount Rushmore of sports icons in this town?
That's the reason we move. I move here. You know, that's the, you know, I mean, I live in, people say, like, you live in Chicago? I say, yeah. Are you crazy? I never said I was right. But my families grew up here. My granddaughter born in Chicago. I feel like I spend more time in Chicago than I spend in Venezuela. And this is my hometown. This is my real hometown, not a fake one. I stay here for good. I think what I did or what we did is a group. Sox fans always gonna appreciate that. And I feel part of Chicago. I don't feel part of White Sox. I think I feel part of Chicago a lot and everything, because I never deny anything with anyone. But in the meanwhile, yes, I feel great. I feel grateful to be part of that. But I think the best day I ever have since 2011, when I went to Chicago White Sox Park, throwing the first pitch ceremony with my granddaughter in my hands. That means our relation with the organization is a lot better now. It was a lot of people, a lot of opinions out there. They don't know really what's going on when I went to Miami and when I was Fidel Castro's number one kid, favorite kid.
That's a whole other show.
Being back in Chicago with the organization I always love, they shaped me, love me back. No defense, the organization. Because what I did for the organization, they should feel the same way I feel about them. You know what I mean? Jerry gave me the opportunity to play and manage the team I love, manage the city I love, grew up in the city. And sorry, Kenny, I always will appreciate that. People think me and Kenny would hate each other. Well, yes, we did. We hate each other for a couple hours because that's our job.
Right.
But in the meanwhile, I talked to them and back with the White Sox organization. I love it. I do have a great time. I think it was something that was bothering me for like a few years. Thanks to Ozzie Jr., went out and talked to a few people at White Sox, how I feel about them exactly. Or like, wait a minute. Then,
the reason that was happening is going back to Chicago. Is that Ozzie was going to be a Chicago guy even if the White Sox never came around. You know, for everyone's, I think the funniest thing is like, Ozzie, you're back. It's like the guy lives here.
Yeah, I live here. He's been living
He's been living in Bucktown. You know, when he went to Miami, he was renting a house. He had just bought like a $3 million house in Bucktown. That's why he wanted to stay in Chicago. We're all from here. You know, Chicago's home to me. Chicago's might be a bigger home to me than Caracas. You know, I was born in Vegas. I never lived in Vegas, but Chicago's home. Home for me. I grew up in the city. The White Sox broke my heart in 1997 when they didn't sign Ozzie back. And I realized this is a business and it's part of the game. And then it happened again as a manager. And I realized the team is not associated to the city. And I can love Chicago because of the people that are in it. Even with all the badness of Chicago, I haven't been so proud about Chicago, even though they didn't have any Latinos. The NBA, the common... was talking about all the greats that came from Chicago.
And it was a bad day, too. It was cold.
It was cold.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. But I love Chicago. And I wanted Ozzie to be okay again with the White Sox because it's part of their history.
Absolutely.
And you want it. But it's all about Chicago. Like, our foundation is going to start focusing more on Chicago. and more we can bring. And I think that it's, out of all the cities in the United States, I think that we represent what the United States is. And immigration and, you know, all the different types of neighborhoods and, you know, from corporate America to, you know, Bucktown and being a hipster and tech and just like construction. So differentiation that we are Chicago, and that's from the south side to the north side to the surrounding suburbs. This is why we made this home. And Chicago, the White Sox were a part of it, but we always wanted to be in Chicago. Then he loves, you know, I think that, God, you got here when you're what, 18 years old?
Well, it's funny because I just, before we started the show, and I look around and I just, first thing come out of my mouth, say, my God, this is a beautiful place. I'm gonna be a lot of places around the world, but you know, I mean, this is a, to me, this is a city, you have everything.
Yeah.
The only bad thing about this city, can I say?
The traffic?
I hate the traffic. Oh my God, I don't know what's wrong. I really don't understand what happened here. You know, I mean, it's traffic everywhere now on. And
but we like construction. That's what we did. We like having construction on highways.
Right. Yeah, well, taxes. I got to say, what's the lady, the new...
Lori? Taxes.
You don't Lori, like please, taxes. Give the taxes down. Because a lot of people moving out of the city.
That's right.
Just because that.
But I think
you're
that's,
killing us.
By the way, that's what I think it makes it a part of... You know what's funny, though? It's so funny when people think that they know you. We've never been involved in any election in Venezuela. Ever. I've never voted in Venezuela. I don't think you've ever voted in Venezuela.
I never will because I say, when I go to vote, I make a line to vote.
Yeah, he's not going to make a line to vote. But like in the last mayor election, we were very involved. You know, we've been involved of either supporting candidates or, hey, right. This would be great for the city because, wow, taxes and we want this for education and what suburb we're going to go. We're like literally involved in the city because we want it to be the best city because we care, because we live here. And this is going to be home. You know, every time you leave O'Hare or Midway, you always want to come back. And that's something that we made it our place. We gave Miami a shot. It was awesome. It was cool weather and it was cool, but it wasn't us. I think that we have that feel for, you know, we love the way that the city is. And that's why I think people think it's like Ozzy's always going to be associated to the city no matter what.
It's great to have the Guillens. Being Guillen is the name of the podcast, which you can find at La Vida Baseball Chicago. Ozzy Guillen Jr., Oney Guillen, and also Ozzy Guillen. Are the co-hosts and Ozzy Jr. are in studio tonight. Can't thank you guys enough. Great conversation. I appreciate you coming in.
No, awesome. Of course. Thank you.
Great to have Ozzy and Ozzy Jr. in studio. Ozzy's just like us. He hates traffic. You always wonder, is celebrities just like us? They put their pants on one leg at a time. Ozzy hates traffic. Great text that came in throughout the hour showing their love for Ozzy Guillen and how he's missed in the White Sox organization. But it's fascinating to me that he goes back and goes and coaches winter ball. It's also fascinating to me that his name was not thrown out at all when it came to many teams looking for managers in a hurry after the cheating scandal. But we like it just fine, and I'm glad that Ozzy is in Chicago. Much more to come on the program tonight. Let's talk about spring break. Tribune had a piece about the top spring break destinations. So let's play my favorite game. Tell me about your vacation. 312-981-7200. We'll do that coming up here in the 10 o'clock hour right after Vic Vaughn's news. Justin Kaufman here, 720 WGN. 312-981-7200. Last hour, of course, we talked with Ozzy Guillen Jr. about their podcast and the state of baseball. The hour before that, though, we talked about the Journalism Town Hall that's coming up on Sunday. Ken Davis and Heather Cerrone were in studio to talk about the challenges facing media organizations and journalists in 2020 and beyond. And of course, we started the program talking about the governor's dual budget proposal, whether or not you thought that was fair. There were a lot of texts about that. We had some good calls about the graduated income tax and whether or not it was reality to show two different budgets, one with the graduated tax and one without, or political theater and essentially blackmail. Those are the conversations we had tonight on the show. But let's talk about spring break. Let's talk about something joyous. Spring break means something to every generation. You could be someone right now whose spring break means absolutely nothing to. You could have a family, and you know that that's a time that you get together when school is off, or maybe you're in college listening to this program saying, spring break, woo! The Tribune put together today the most popular spring break destinations in America. This is interesting because of the 30 places that were actually mentioned, 20 some odd of them are in Florida. But it was surprising, and these are places inside America. There was Phoenix, Flagstaff, the Arizona There was some Colorado Springs, a couple of Colorado towns. California had Los Angeles and San Diego. And then Florida had a slew. There was, I think, Asheville, North Carolina also was on the list. But it made me think about one of the segments we've done in the past, which I love, which is very simple. It is great in its simplicity. Tell me about your vacation. 312-981-7200. I like it. I like this. I remember the one time we did it, a woman called up and she told us about how she went to the Wheel of Fortune taping. That's all you do. You call up or you text in. Just tell us about your vacation, your favorite vacation. The could be spring break, and that's why we bring it up now. Could be a different vacation, but something where it was successful, or a horror story, whatever you want it to be. And there's not a lot that goes into it. I just answer the phone by saying, tell me about your vacation. Simple, riveting concept. 312-981-7200. So call us and tell us about your vacation. I'm looking forward to spring break this year, going out of the country, going to the ABC Islands, which is a area that I know not a lot about. But thanks to research, I found more about it that I probably don't speak the right language. It's either Dutch or Spanish down there. But it's going to be a lot of fun. It's a trip that we're going with family, my parents, and should be a lot of fun at the beginning of April. CPS is always strange in the way that they do spring break after everybody else. My son goes to public schools, but the suburban schools and other places, they will have normal spring breaks in March, which is usual and a good thing to break from the not only the school year, but the monotony of winter. But nah. CPS is like, how about the middle of April? Nobody wants to be in Chicago in the middle of April. Said nobody. It always bums me out because you're like, that's when you want to be in Chicago, when the weather breaks and you get a 60-degree day. You don't want to be heading down to Clearwater Beach or different places in Florida. This popular spring break destination story has, let me give you the top places. So the first one, they said that this was one of those slideshows where it's not really the Tribune, they're just borrowing it, putting it on the page. It talks about the methodology to pick the most popular spring break destination. They analyzed data from number crunchers at travel booking companies. They also looked at a study of market research from a couple different sites. These were the destinations that were most tracked and most searched for when it came to spring break 2019. So the first can be Las Vegas, Nevada. Okay. In springtime, it's not sweltering. The average temperature in March is 71 degrees, whereas in May, it's 91. In addition to casinos, nightclubs, and shopping, Sin City is home to many shows, blah, 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 blah. Vegas would not be my choice for a spring break destination. I'm not trying to harp on the town, but it just seems like that's, yeah, maybe I guess it's all about your age. Maybe that is a strong destination for someone who's in their 20s. But I can't see that being a place to go. Hollywood, California, Los Angeles. They talk about all the different things you can do in that area. We'll skip explaining what Los Angeles is to people. Miami, Florida comes in number 3. Fort Lauderdale, Florida, number 4. Phoenix, Arizona, number 5. Honolulu, Hawaii, sure. Sure, yeah, go for it. Who doesn't like Honolulu, Hawaii? They don't tell you. First of all, if this is based on searches for spring break, of course it's the first place you're going to search. Doesn't mean you're actually serious about going. You search, you go, and then you get there and you're like, how much? Nah. What else they got in Florida? Honolulu. Tampa, Florida is the next one. That's more my speed. That's where all my cousins are at. New Orleans comes in at 9. Colorado Springs, more Hawaii, Flagstaff, Arizona, Destin, Florida, San Jose, California. That's an interesting one. Punta Gorda, Florida, St. Petersburg, Florida, Panama City Beach, Florida. Really, all these towns. Valparaiso, Florida. Big Sky, Montana makes the list. So one of the cooler places on the list with springtime temperatures ranging from 43 to 59. So why are people flocking to Big Sky, Montana? The third largest ski area in North America. So you can go skiing at that point. There you go. Siesta Key, Florida, Marco Island, Winter Park, that's more skiing. Scottsdale, Arizona. Is there a fan of strip malls? Something like that. All right, 312-981-7200. 815 says, as I asked about how your vacation is, youngest daughter is a freshman at Augustana, so for spring break, we're bringing the entire family to Hard Rock Riviera Maya. 32 days from now, but who's counting? But according to our kids, for our 10-year wedding anniversary, my wife and I brought them to Turks and Caicos. The beach is all-inclusive. It was fantastic. That's their favorite vacation. That sounds like a nice job. That's good. Tell me about your vacation, 847. I was in eighth grade. My family drive to Florida for spring break. We had reservations in Jacksonville. Drive in at dusk. There were college kids all over the streets. I saw many lady parts hanging out through the minivan window. This is going to be great, I thought. My dad just kept driving till we hit a nice retirement town. Still, the greatest spring break ever. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Tell me about your vacation. Justin Kaufman with you here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. 720 WGN Radio here. Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We're talking about your favorite vacation. We were looking at an article that was in the Tribune about the most popular spring break destinations. So I ask you, 312-981-7200, tell me about your vacation. Did you just get back? Are you about to go? Do you have one, like some of our texters just pointed out, that stands out? Where you skipped the spring break revelry because your dad drove to the retirement town instead? 312-981-7200. 312, mentioning the ABC Islands that we're going to. If you love beaches, you'll love Aruba. If you love diving and flamingos, you'll love Bonaire. If you love culture, you'll love Curacao. They can be hot, but they all have a nice breeze. Enjoy. Yes, we're going to Curacao. So I guess it's a culture trip. This was a trip that my mom, a lot of people had wanted to do this trip. It was relatively and surprisingly inexpensive. But it was something that this is a monumental moment for our family, as birthdays and things like that. So we're all going together. I don't know much about it, but I heard snorkeling is great. And it's the Dutch Islands. It looks really, really pretty. So I'm looking forward to it. And the best part about it is that you can snorkel from the beach. And I've talked about when I went to Jamaica that I snorkeled where they took a boat out into the ocean and you just kind of jump in, which is not my favorite thing in the world. I'm not going to lie to you. that was a little bit more like, I don't like that I can't get back to shore. So this is one where I'm like, oh, this is better. You can just stand there at the beach, look down, go back and get another beer. All right, here we go. You ready? Steve, tell us about your vacation.
Oh, I think our favorite one we go about every 2 years is Atlantis, Bahamas.
Yeah.
Especially last year was the best because my son just turned 18. So, you know, had to have a little fun with our son while we're out there, too.
That's great. How did you guys land on that? You just decided over and over it was a good time the first time?
We went about 10 years ago for the first time, fell in love with it. I actually got a timeshare out there now, so nice. We continue going out there at least every 2 years.
Oh, that's great. That's awesome. Thanks for calling, Steve.
You got it, buddy. Have a good one.
Yeah, how about that? That sounds great. That's the way to go, right? Every 2 years you go out to the Bahamas? You told me about your vacation. 312 says, just got back from my niece's destination wedding in Costa Rica. Beautiful country, super people, fabulous food, beaches and mountains. Finished the trip by dropping down to Panama to see the canal. Oh, a fan of infrastructure, are you? Listen, I know we all want to go home. It was a great wedding. But if we could just roll a couple countries over, so I could see the Panama Canal. That would be great. I've heard great things about Panama. 312-981-7200 is the phone number, and I want you to tell me about your vacation. That's the segment. It's very simple, as Steve did a good job of just getting right to it. You can text or you can call in. This, of course, because the Tribune put up the most popular spring break destinations. When I was a kid, the spring break destinations were to my grandma and grandpa's house in Cave Creek, Arizona. It was very hot, and they had a pool. That's what I mean about Scottsdale. It's one long suburban strip. And I also remember when I was 16 years old, and I always, this is a story that is so vague, but my best friend's sister was of age. So she might have been 24, 25, and we were 16. Me and my friend Richie. And her and her friend were going to Florida for spring break. And I somehow convinced, we both convinced our parents that we would go with the two 16-year-olds and go for a week to, I think it was Tampa. And it somehow worked. And the thing that was also strange about it is it wasn't spring break time for school. So we somehow just got out of school. We got out of high school. Maybe we were seniors. I can't, juniors or seniors. And we went down there. We had very little money. I remember that. I remember like having quarters and trying to figure out how we're going to get to anything. And all we did as cool 16-year-olds was just kind of walk up and down the beach. Never hung out with his sisters or anything like that. It was just me and Richie walking up and down the street. Going, you know. And then I remember we went and spent the only money we had on novelty t-shirts at the mall. I think there was like a cool mall shop that had t-shirts, and I got a Yo MTV Raps t-shirt. That was like for $14 or whatever it was at the time, $7. And I just remember it's either on the way back that we were all sisters and the 16 were all dumping all of our coins into a hat to see if we had enough for gas to get back to Wonder Lake. And I look back on that, I'm like, what a weird thing for my parents or Richie's parents, anyone to be like, yeah, you guys can just go. Because they were going to have fun. We're like, we'll have fun too. We'll just walk up and down the beach. And that's all I remember from that. Because we weren't old enough to drink. We weren't old enough. We didn't have any money to buy food, go to any. It wasn't a special family vacation. Just like we were cool to go down to Tampa and walk on the beach. It's a very strange trip. Good times, I guess. 708 says, vacation, I'm heading down to Australia to party with the Stones. That's a good vacation. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're talking about your favorite vacation or what you're planning to do for spring break. Tribune had the most popular spring break destinations in America. Not surprising, most of them were from Florida, almost all of them. And then the couple of Californias, couple of Colorados, but and Arizonas. 412 says, the worst vacation, my worst vacation, was last October. I was trapped by two wildfires, one in Southern Cal and one in Northern California. I had to sleep on the side of the freeway. National Guard would not let anyone enter any town, so no electric, no gas stations, nothing open, no food. Oh my gosh. You don't really think about that, people being out in California for vacation time, getting caught in between. Jeez. I don't know about that. 708 says, come on, Justin, you know your best vacation was at that cabin in Wisconsin that your dad borrowed for a week from his coworker. Yeah, that's a good story. Boulder Junction. That was a good story. So I was catching muskies or northern pike. 312-981-7200. That was a good vacation. That was more of a summer lake vacation. Something like that. All right. John, tell me about your vacation.
Yeah, hi. I'm sorry. When I was a junior in high school, my dad decided he wanted to go to Daytona Beach, Florida.
Nice.
And said we could take a friend. And so we rented this ugly blue station wagon. And we drove down very much National Lampoon Vacation to Florida. We get to Daytona Beach. He checks us into a Radisson hotel and then takes the car and leaves and goes and stays with his sister in Ormond Beach.
What?
we are two. It was a 16, 17, and an 18-year-old. We were in Daytona Beach during spring break by ourselves.
Wow. Did you get into trouble?
Here and there. That's what it's all about.
Yeah, that's what it says. It's like me walking up and down the beach. All you do is walk up and down the beach, and you're like, yeah, let's do another cruise.
Well, we thought we were fancy when we got someone to buy us Michelob, because it was an adult-sounding beer.
Very adult. Very adult. John, thanks for the call, man.
All right, man. Take care.
That is true. Michelob is, if you can get that or Löwenbräu, oh, man, you're in business. 815 says, best spring break, 93, was in Egypt. No, wait, I was in the army, stuck in the middle of the desert. Never mind. That sucked. That's what he says. That's great. Hey, yeah, there's a difference between deployment and spring break vacation, I'll bet. Right? I know there's some people that will go to spring break. Their spring break will be down in spring training in Arizona. There are a lot of groups that get together at this point, and they go down to watch the Sox or the Cubs, right? I would always want to do that, but that's an expensive venture. That's more expensive than gathering your nickels and dimes and hitching a ride with Richie's sister down to Tampa. 785 says, worst family vacation ever, driving from Kansas to Oregon. Oh, with grandparents smoking in the car the whole way back. 1977. I have a story like that. I think it might have been spring break, summertime. No, I think it was spring break, and I drove with my dad and my grandpa to San Diego. And we drove. And I remember just getting an idea to understand how tipping works. So I remember we had breakfast at a place in Texas. And I can't remember her name, but there was a waitress that I really liked. I was maybe like 12 years old. I really liked her, and my grandpa put down $3 or something like that, which I didn't realize percentages. So I'm like, I didn't say anything, but I was also like, that's all you could shell out? I mean, the breakfast was probably $15 or whatever. And then we went to another place where we met up with my aunt and uncle, and it was a dinner, and the waiter was not cool, like not as cool as Sparky was back in Texas. And everyone, the tip on that was $20 or something like that. And I got mad. I'm like, how dare you give? Why you give 20 here and you only give Mitzi 3? I got no idea about percentages. Real strong. 312-981-7200. Tell me about your vacation. We're playing it tonight here on 720 WGN. Getting some good stuff. Stay with us. Talking about vacation, spring break. People texting in their favorite vacations. I love this simple segment, which we've done a couple of times here on WGN. It's very simple concept. Tell me about your vacation. Tell me about your vacation. 312 wants to go, Justin, do you give your kids a voice in picking a vacation? Or just tell them, pack your stuff, you're going to blank. That's a great question. Probably pack your stuff. I think in some cases there have been choices that were already picked. You want to go here, here, or here kind of thing. And then they say this, oh, I want to go here. And you go, no, how about this one? We went to Florida for a number of years with my parents when Miles was a young baby, up to 6 years old or something like that. Naples, which I found out a lot about Naples. I found Jerry Taft drives an Uber there. I remember that story. But Naples is a golf community, and it's a community that is pretty old in a good way, but it's a lot of people that live there. The town shuts down. So it was always funny that one of the nights was date night for me and my wife, because it would be like, then my parents would keep Miles at home, that kind of thing. and we would hit the town, and it would be 7, 8 o'clock at night. We'd eat dinner, and it'd be like, you'd walk in there to one of the restaurants on the strip, and they'd be like, yeah, I guess we could do one more. You're like, I guess we can do, I guess we're not, because the kitchen closed? It closes at 8:15? Just like, what? It doesn't have that late night Chicago vibe. But beautiful beaches. The one thing I remember about Naples that I always is that I when I was a kid, we would take spring breaks. Great vacations. And one time when I got into this weird fascination with marine biology. I think I was maybe 12 or 13. I said, I want to be a marine biologist. I wanted to study dolphins. A kid from the Midwest in Wonder Lake going, oh, you know what I want to do? I want to swim with the whales. And we went out west to the Pacific Ocean and one time to the Atlantic Ocean. I just spent the whole time with binoculars trying to just get a glimpse of a dolphin, right? Or a whale, something cool, seal. I'll even take a seal. In Naples, the dolphins are like panhandlers. There are two or three of them that just hang around the pier there. Like mutts. Like feral cats that think you have tuna. So they're just hanging around. And the first time I went to Naples, I'm like, oh, look at, everybody look, it's a dolphin. Like my mind had been blown. Like we got so lucky on day one. And then by the fourth year we were in Naples, I'm like, get out of here. Shoo. Shoo. I don't know if that's the case. Maybe people in Florida are just not that enamored with the marine life. I really thought when I saw the fin, I'm like, this is it. I finally get to see a dolphin. And everyone's like, these dolphins are part of the show. They're begging for food. They're not dumb. There's a lot of fishermen around the... Then I started thinking in my head, I'm like, well, my parents just didn't take me to this kind of stuff. Here we are, like in nature, like along the cliffs or the rocks, and I can't find a dolphin in sight. If they would have taken me to the mainstream pier, all the dolphins just hanging out. Or like in San Francisco, all the seals, right? The sea lions just hanging out. So I can't tell if it was just dumb luck or I just was steered in the wrong direction by my parents. 773 says, you and George Costanza. The sea was angry that day, my friend. 847 says, I go to Florida. I've done it a few times. Fit some spring training games in, especially in Tampa and Orlando. That'd be fun. 312 says, in the spring of 2007, my wife, son, and I went to Oahu, stayed in the Rainbow Tower of the Hilton Hawaiian Village with a gorgeous view looking up Waikiki Beach and Diamond Head. These are all things that I have heard, but they don't mean anything to me. I'm not a huge Hawaii guy. I don't know what that even means. I wasn't a huge Magnum PI kind of guy. But all those things right there are iconic, and I can't place them. We rented a Jeep, drove around the island, swimming at various beaches. The highlight through was going to the property they used as Robin's Nest in the old Magnum PI show. That's awesome. We spent a couple hours swimming in the tidal pool. By the way, the property was sold to President Obama's friend, Marty Nesbitt. They tore it down, and the rumor is the Obamas are going to use it as their vacation residence. Steve. Yeah, there you go. Get some political rumors in there, too. Why not, right? Marty Nesbitt was on this program. I should have asked him about it. Before we go, I know we're talking about the Obama Foundation and the Obama Center. Hilton Head. Diamond Snakehead. 312-981-7200. Phone number. We're talking about vacations. And I want to move on, but I got also talk about vacations all night long. I love it. I talked at the beginning of the show about the story that Blair Kamen had, which I think is one of the best columns I've read all week. The column is from Blair Kamen. He's the architecture critic for the Chicago Tribune. Does fascinating. He does great work, doesn't he? He's always writing good stuff. The column today was, is Chicago's fear of fire ebbing? Nearly 150 years after the Great Fire, the city steps gingerly into innovative mass timber. What? Starts the column. Wood is having a moment in the world of architecture. Other cities, including Milwaukee and Minneapolis, are going all in on an innovative type of wood. Wood boosters claim takes less energy to produce than concrete or steel. It's not stick like 2x4s. It goes by the catch-all phrase mass timber, which encompasses a series of engineered wood products that are laminated, nailed, or pressed together to form solid, high-strength wood panels. Typically, mass timber forms the internal structure of a building and is left exposed, like old lofts. Milwaukee is breaking ground on a 25-story residential tower that will be built as the world's tallest mass timber structure. Wow. And last week, when Related Midwest announced it was going to start construction on the 78, the mega project on the Chicago River, the developer's president hinted that the project's first phase could include low-rise office buildings supported by mass timber. Wow, we are with the times. The only problem, and he mentions this in the piece, is to think that we are being foolish enough to say, you know what, wood is so cool. It's the hip building material of the day. And not recognize that the Great Chicago Fire of 1871 incinerated vast stretches of the city because all of it was built by wood. We changed modern architecture because we did not want to be in a position where a fire could eviscerate an entire downtown area. Until the new developers are like, you know what would be cool? Wood. You know what's retro? You know what's making a comeback? Wood. I don't know how I feel about that. As a student of Chicago history, I'm doing this architecture program or project with my son for his history fair about architecture before and after the fire. They went out of their way to recognize the role wood played in why a whole entire downtown of Chicago was burned to the ground. The biggest moment in this city's history. They changed the city building codes. They changed everything. Everyone just decided it has to be steel and we had to do sprinklers, all that kind of stuff. And to think that someone in 2020 would introduce a much more efficient, much better way to build buildings. And really have no concept or recognition of what happened in the past, I find that to be downright shameful. And I'm sure, I'm not dumb. I know the texters have come in saying it's a different kind. Oh, it's wood, it's a different day. They have sprinklers, all that kind of stuff. I don't know. At a certain point, it's just blasphemy. I don't build wood. The idea that, first of all, those mega projects, the Lincoln Park, the one, the Lincoln Yards one, we can talk about that tonight, and the 78 and all these places, they're getting so many tax breaks and so many favors from the city to do these projects. It just blows my mind that they would build something out of wood. It just, I don't know. It's almost like, I know it sounds, I know people are like, get over it. But it feels like a flip of the chin to Chicago's history. Like, you know, that's what I think of your history. I'm going to build wood everything. Your wood swimming pools, wood jacuzzis, wood tables. Oh, I get so mad about it. 412 says, the sidewalks were wood in Chicago when the fire hit. Yeah. That's what I mean. And you know they're going to do that down in the new projects. They'll be like, oh, yeah, you know what would be great right here? A boardwalk, a nice wood boardwalk, sidewalk. They're just like, they're yuppifying us right into a moment of late 19th century history. That's what they said, 773. It's fashionable. That's scary to think about. And maybe I get it. I'm completely overreacting, although you're texting and agreeing with me. But I just feel like there's some things that you just... I'm trying to think of an analogy or metaphor. Please help me out. 312-981-7200. You know, it's like when you're from Salem, Massachusetts. You know, it would be great. What if we just did, like, a witch festival? Like, maybe not. You know, there's a lot of history and witches here. It's not a good metaphor. But it's the same concept, right? This idea that maybe there are some things that are so sacred in history that if you're going to build and you're going to get city money, don't mess around with that stuff. I don't know. It feels like a flip of the chin. A flip of the chin to all of us in our history. 312-981-7200. What do you think of that? Am I overreacting? I feel like I'm overreacting, but you can back me up. We'll take a break. Stay with us. 312-981-7200. Getting some great texts about my overreaction about Blair Kamen's column in the Tribune today, where some of the mega projects that are happening in Milwaukee and Minnesota are coming here. And it was hinted that some of the new projects that will be built for the 78, which is the new neighborhood that will be along the south branch of the Chicago River, they're going to build it in wood. There's new flavor. It's mass timber. Everything, they want to look timber. And the only problem with that is that we come from the history. We're all taught, and if we don't know it, then ye, that the Great Chicago Fire wouldn't have been the Great Chicago Fire if the whole downtown wasn't built by wood. And I'm not trying to be like a fire safety expert. That's not my point. I just think it's a little bit disrespectful to the history of this town and what it means to us and everything that had to go into after the fact to get all trendy and be like, you know what would be great down here? Wood. Joanne, you agree with me?
120%.
Yes. Right? Why do you agree? What's your point?
Well, that's the reason why the Chicago Fire happened.
Right.
Was because it was also a perfect storm, right? So it was the time of year, there was a drought, the kindling was there, but it was also because of the fact that the downtown area and the surrounding area was completely built from wood.
Right.
And I agree with what you said too, with after the Chicago Fire, when the city rebuilt, they completely rethought how they were going to rebuild the city. You know, there was no structures that were allowed to be built from wood outside a certain radius of the city.
It's so interesting. And I have to say, Joanne, you'll like this stream, I know this, but I was doing this project with my son for architecture before and after, and I learned the Green Door Tavern, which is on Orleans, which is kind of by Mr. Beef in that area, which is north of the Ontario ramp where you get on the coming to River North. It's the oldest tavern in Chicago. It is built wood. And it's interesting because it was built months after the Chicago Fire before they put the ordinance in saying no wood. And so if you stand on the other side of the block and you look at it, it totally is... It stands out. It is a sore thumb, and all, it's amazing to see because you don't see wood built anything downtown.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I just don't think and bringing the what's happening with the world right now with climate change and everything else, I'm a little bit nervous.
Right.
About something like that being brought in when we don't know what's happening with the weather and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Thanks, Joanne. Thanks for the call. You're absolutely right. Now, they'll tell you, and there's probably truth to this, to be honest, and someone pointed it out, I think, in text in, that it's sustainable building, that they're looking to create a more efficient build homes or buildings or whatever that are going to use less energy, both to create and to exist. And that the wood that they're using is a different kind of wood. That's my favorite thing. It's a different kind of wood. Well, all right. Okay. And Joanne was right. She's very on the nose. That's how the fire. And I get all that. And I have faith that the building materials have evolved since 1871. Right? I just find it to be somewhat disrespectful. I'm taking the historical Chicago point of view. Not that I'm worried there's going to be another great Chicago fire. That stuff might work in Minneapolis. It might work in Milwaukee. It might work in other towns that have not had such a traumatic history with wood buildings in downtown Chicago. So if you're going to build the next mega development that is going to be the new neighborhood, it's going to be so hot, it's going to be the spot, and you build it with wood, are you even from here? There's no better material you could use to be efficient and reduce your carbon footprint. You have to use this wood? I don't know, man. 412 says, you're spot on, Justin. Thank you, buddy. 815 says, how long should we be afraid, though? If the streets and the sidewalks are not wood and they put the proper precautions in, less of an impact on the environment, it's less costly, how long do we need to be afraid? 100 years? 200 years? I don't know. It's not even about being afraid. Like I said, I think it's more about just respect. 708 says, it seems to me that the tragedy didn't happen in your lifetime. The significance of the event has no impact. It occurs in many aspects of life. We're destined to repeat history. Right. That's my fear. It's not that long ago, guys. It's 150 years, 1871. It's not that long ago. I know that we act like, of course, it's generations and centuries now. It's just not that long ago. Again, I want to get to some people who don't think that I'm spot on, which is always hard to find people like that because I'm always on spot on. I'm always bringing it. So 847 says, this sounds like the same design crowd that brought us the so-called Edison lights. We moved on to more efficient and attractive lighting, but they think it looks authentic. Yeah. It's interesting. I didn't think I'd get so incensed by the article. And Blair, it was a great article. It was a great column. And I thought he hit it right on the head. I don't know. And maybe it's because we just went around taking pictures of some of this architecture and learning more about it. 708 says, I don't think there are any more cows or lanterns in Chicago. I don't know. Maybe it's because I don't want to say I'm salty. That's not the right word. But I am interested. Caution. I'm watching with expressed caution on the developments, the mega developments in town, and whether or not they're going to fit in and be part of Chicago, or if they're really a moment where they're taking over Chicago or changing Chicago, because that's what, you know, they bought the land and they're developers and they want to develop it into something different. And so maybe it's a little bit of that, where I'm not at all one of the people who says don't build it. I just want it to be built to be in harmony with the city in which we live. And right off the bat, to determine that your new building, it's going to be wood. Right off the bat, like, are you guys from here? You say you're from here. You call your company Related Midwest. Yeah, it's going to be wood. Because nothing's ever been built here that's wood, and we'll be the first. Okay. So I don't know. And next week, let's talk about Lincoln Yards. Because that one is in political hot water, where they had a sustainability development study that the city said that they did, and then they found out that the study was actually done by Sterling Bay, the people who are building there. they just wrote it for the city, not unlike the things that we would get mad about the EPA when Pruitt was on in charge of EPA, and then you saw that it was being written by coal companies, like the policies for the EPA. It's the same concept here. I don't know why people aren't more outraged that we were told it was a city study when it was a study that was actually from the developer. And guess what the study said? Ah, everything's fine. So good. 870 gets the last line. Chicago Fire Part 2 will be started by hipsters and their heated chicken coops. We don't need to worry about wood. All right, we'll take a break. Nick DiGilio up next here on 720 WGN.